Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Not to serialize the nature of this program, but let's pick up where we left off last night, in a way. I want to offer congratulations to the 10,000 people who marched in Midtown Manhattan and protested in front of the Mormon temple there. Proud of them. I'm sure it wasn't all gay, it wasn't all straight, it wasn't all bi. It was just Americans demanding that this attempt to enforce theology on government end. Just proud. And down toward the end of the article that I'm looking at, from GayCityNews.com, Prop 8 backlash hits New York City Mormon temple. Down toward the bottom of that, there's a little confirmation of something that I've been trying to make abundantly clear. The final paragraph says the right wing, flushed from its West Coast victory, knows what it is going to do next. With the legislatures of New York and New Jersey judged the most likely to move affirmatively on marriage equality, Christian rightly, I wish they'd quit calling them Christians. I really, honest Pete, do. Right-wing fundamentalist leaders have announced plans to head east pronto. They also pledged to make a cottage industry out of their win last week in Arkansas. And this is the point that I was trying to make, and I think I have made, and I hope you take to heart, because it's real. And the threat from these theocratic fascist punks is real. The state of Arkansas. You know, we've talked about Florida, we've talked about Arizona, Lord knows we've talked about California. But in the state of Arkansas, the right-wing fundies got a win. But as I have warned repeatedly, it impacted everyone. Consider for a moment, if you will, the plight of abused children. I have seen more in that realm than I care to remember. I know what the term actually means. I know the physical manifestations of it. Consider the plight of abused children, beaten, whipped, subjected to sexual abuse and outright incest. Children whose lives have been rendered a living hell. Those children, if they are rescued, if they are saved, those children find their way into something that is referred to in most corners of this country as the foster care system. And that foster care system is as rife with abuses and as rife with problems and as poorly, tragically underfunded as any particular area in our social structure, thanks to Republican rule. And for many children, it is out of the frying pan and into the fire. because one of the groups that's most into the foster parent business, and it is a business, are religious fundamentalists. They get these poor, pathetic human beings from infancy up to adolescence, and they bring them into their home, these fundies do, and start subjecting them to their fundamentalist way of life. And it is sad and it is sick. There aren't enough secular or humanist or non-theist people out there willing to serve in the capacity of foster parents. Some of these foster children are eventually legally separated from their parents, with the abusing parents' parental rights being terminated in various and sundry judicial processes. They are then permanently in foster care pending someone who is willing to adopt them. Do you have any idea how hard it is to find an adoptive parent for an adolescent abused child? It is incredibly difficult. It has gotten worse in Arkansas. On Election Day 2008, as Arkansas was busy giving its Electoral College votes to that sad old man, they were doing other things too. They gave their approval to legislation via the ballot box in Arkansas that keeps any unmarried couple, and presumably any single person, from serving as foster parents in the state of Arkansas. Their goal was to keep gay people from serving as foster parents in the state of Arkansas. But they also made sure that no unmarried couple could serve in that capacity. I hope you understand now how serious I am when I say that these people are coming for you, regardless of your sexual orientation. It is your status as not being a member of their theocratic cult that puts you at hazard from them. If at any point in time you have considered, in light of the issues raised by Proposition 8 in California or by all the DOMAs, the Defense of Marriage Amendments, that have cropped up like poisonous toadstools across this country. If at any time you have thought that you did not have a dog in this hunt, I hope the light is now on. I told you last night that the move is to go back into the states, the several states, and do this state by state by state, like unto the domino theory propounded by the hardcore right wing and the conservatives, who said, well, you know, if we don't get 60,000 Americans slaughtered in Vietnam, well, it'll be a domino theory, and it'll be one state after Vietnam will fall, and the next thing you know, they'll be in Hawaii. Right? Now, that was crazy. Communism didn't have that reach. But here in the United States of America, religious fundamentalism does have that reach. And they have set out to make sure that their reach does not exceed their grasp. I keep telling you, time and again, they are flush. They have the bit in their teeth. America elected its first African-American president, and the religious fundamentalists at the same time managed to enshrine their bigotry in law. And somewhere out there, tonight, today, somewhere out there in Arkansas, a child protective service worker is entering a home. And in that home, there is a cradle. And lying in that cradle is an infant. And that infant may have a spiral fracture of a leg or an arm. That infant may have brain damage from the shaking it has received from a mother or a father. Perhaps the child is older and not an infant and has welts across its back or burns in its skin from a cigarette. Who knows what the precise abuse is? But somewhere in Arkansas, that child exists. Most likely in Arkansas, that child exists in more than one county. Several children, perhaps in Little Rock or Hot Springs. And those children will be removed from the home lest those children be killed. And it doesn't matter how good an unmarried couple is. It doesn't matter how competent that unmarried couple is. The only thing that matters is a marriage certificate. Imagine that. A child desperately in need of nurturing and care. If there was a pair of child psychologists who cohabitate, gay or straight, but they did not have the official seal of approval on their relationship from the state of Arkansas, that couple could not take in a child that would manifestly benefit by their care, from their love, from their understanding, and by their willingness to try to heal the wounds that the birth family had imposed. If those two people, gay or straight, didn't have that marriage license, it wouldn't matter if they were physicians. It wouldn't matter if they were special education teachers, best suited to deal with raising a child, for instance, that has been subjected to shaken baby syndrome and received brain damage. It wouldn't matter. The only thing that matters, because of the manifest hate that pours and flows like a toxic river out of the religion industry, the fundamentalist religion industry in this country, the only thing that matters is that they're marrying the eyes of Jesus. Suffer the little children to come unto me. Do you realize that the guy who said that couldn't be a foster parent in Arkansas? Really? Jesus H. Christ could not be a foster parent in Arkansas because he's not married. And that's the way the right-wing fundamentalist religion industry wants things. And that shows, again, how sick they are and how willing they are to sacrifice the most fragile, the most vulnerable among us. It drives it on home, doesn't it? Can you imagine? Can you imagine being a voter and going to the polls in the state of Arkansas and using your franchise, your vote, that was bought and paid for you in human blood to impose bigotry on others? Can you imagine that? What is it like inside the skull of somebody who is willing to do that? Dear God! Anyone that would harm the least of these, it would have been better had he not ever been born. Isn't that what the book says? And yet, fundamentalists went to the polls in their droves, and they did precisely what their God said not to do. See, in many ways, not to put too fine a theological point on it, but that's what you get when you turn a bold and brilliant man into a god. When a man stands up in the face of a violent culture and says, the greatest commandment is to love God, and the second greatest commandment is to love your neighbor. When a man does that, a finite man, a man of blood and bone and sinew, when a man does that, a mortal does that, it's heroic. But if a God does it, what's it to him? He's going to be God. He's already God. You know, God, God, God. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. It's a cop-out. Oh, well, I can't live like Jesus because I ain't a God. Maybe that's why I take the things that he is said to have spoken a little more seriously. Because there's courage there. You see, 2,000 years ago in Roman-occupied Palestine, there was no culture of the child. There was no cult of the child. Infant mortality, and in fact maternal mortality, was so profound as to prevent parents from really, really forming lasting bonds with their offspring until they had some certitude that they would reach adulthood. Where do you think the entry into adulthood ceremonies, for instance, the Egyptian ceremonies that were later co-opted by other cultures, happened about 13 years old? Where do you think they came from? At 13, you could make an assumption that they might see adulthood. But until then, nah, no, not so much. And in a brutish culture, where the odds were stacked against children, for a human being to say that children actually mattered in and of themselves was profound in a way that I don't know if we can fully comprehend. But in Arkansas, They are trying to create a culture that is as brutish as the one in which Yeshua, the itinerant rabbi, walked. And they are succeeding. And they are succeeding on our silence. No, you don't live in Arkansas, most of you. Most of you couldn't vote there. But how much time did we talk about it? I'll be honest, I had no idea it was going on. And I'm ashamed. Oh, they beat back that stupid thing in Colorado that would have declared a zygote to be a fully functioning human being. And, but that's just another that's another aspect of this toxically three-dimensional piece of right-wing theocratic hate. Imagine, Colorado wanted to declare that a zygote, Colorado fundamentalist wanted to declare that a zygote had full human rights at the same time that Arkansas, some several hundred miles away, wanted to declare that full-grown human beings had less. You had aching yet? It's been driving me nuts all day long. But the weirdos are coming out of the woodwork. I offer as Exhibit 1 a message that I got from our pal Sophie. This is a letter dated today to Barack Obama. Dear President-elect Obama, first, congratulations on your victory. The historical magnitude of your presidential win is nothing short of stupendous and a colossal fulfillment of the American dream, an achievement embedded long ago in the equality clauses of the Declaration of Independence. We might have to talk about that. It's likely no big surprise that I don't see eye to eye with you politically. Actually, I stand in stark opposition to most of your politics. Still, I realize that we must learn to work together if we are to see our country get back on track. After Election Day, I asked myself, how can I work with our new president to help better America? Then a thought occurred to me. The first question that should be answered is, how will you work for me? After all, we, the people of the United States, employ you, correct? So here are a few ways you might begin to gain the respect of those who oppose you, and to show that your campaign pledges to bridge the divides were not empty promises to get you into office. And these requests I make are based upon the inaugural oath you will make on January 20th. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. No doubt these won't be my only requests through the years, but they serve as a good beginning. Use and cite the Constitution. If that constitutional oath, preserve, protect, and defend, is the central duty of your job description, then I assume we will be hearing often from you about exactly how you're doing just that. There's no replacement for strict adherence, application, and defense of the Constitution, and it's high time that presidents quit reciting the presidential oath tritely and then abandoning its tenets when they enter the Oval Office. You should be quoting from the Constitution publicly as often as a preacher quotes from the Bible to his congregation, at least weekly. If you take this oath and challenge seriously, you will limit the powers of federal government, reduce taxes for everyone, encourage the freedom of religion and expression even in the public square, and stand up for such things as our right to bear arms. The American public and the government have lost their grip on the content and role of the Constitution, but if you daily choose, you can help to re-educate and model its usage for them. This guy sounds like some sort of an elitist. Protect American life. Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1809, quote, "The care of human life and happiness, and not their destruction, is the first and only legitimate object of good government." Those are powerful and enlightening words. Of course, such a role was created and secured in the very fabric of our nation in the Declaration of Independence. The commitment to protect life should serve as the basis for all you do, even as a foundation for your national defense strategy. I'm sure the first of your secret briefings this past week on our global security threats have opened your eyes to the extensive onslaught of our enemies. Don't allow your pride, partisanship, personal bias, or political abilities to jeopardize the safety of American lives. As Commander-in-Chief, you are called to preserve American life. Quite frankly, that is why I'm surprised that a man such as you, who professes to fight for minorities, would not recognize the clear value of a human life in a womb. Federal law should not decree the sacrifice of one human life for the preference of another. Both lives should be protected. Otherwise, what do Jefferson's 1809 words mean? As president, you are called to protect, not destroy, human life. It is the first and only legitimate object of good government. Lead more from the center. It's been pointed out by countless pundits, and your track record is clear. You have one of the most liberal records in the Senate. You've had the liberty of voting and fighting for an agenda from the left as you've tried to persuade state and federal lawmakers to do the same. But if you continue to lead our country down a more liberal road, you will follow the peril of Bill Clinton, who stepped into office and initially tried to lift the ban on gays in the military and extend abortion rights, only to prompt the creation of a more balanced and strong Republican Congress in the 1990s. Don't underestimate the resurrecting power of the conservative voice. You observed in last week's election how three states across this union voted to protect marriage in their constitutions. The 28th, 29th, and 30th states to do so, California, Arizona, and Florida. We will be watching who you choose to be in your cabinet. We will discern how you lead Pelosi and Reid. We will be observing those you select as candidates for Supreme Court justices. The election is over. No more promises. No more words. You might work well in a team, but this time you don't have congressional members to hide behind. You're on your own, leading the pack, and the whole country is watching. I especially am watching. So make sure you lead more from the center. One of your 300 million bosses, Chuck Norris. Mom, Dad, you might want to run little Timmy and little Susie out of the room. Just for a minute. I'll give you a sec. Just, no, step on out of the room, honey. Uncle Bob's probably going to say something nasty he doesn't want you to hear.
Eat shit and die, Chuck Norris! You go to hell, Chuck Norris. How dare you, you murderous, monstrous, hellacious, demonic freak! How dare you deem yourself competent to lecture Barack Obama on how to protect life when you, you by God merciless bastard, stood silent whilst thousands, nay, tens of thousands, nay, hundreds of thousands, yea, verily, nigh unto a million Iraqi civilians were slaughtered, not only with your connivance, but with your approval. We must work together if we're to see our country get back on track. Damn, Chuck, you're one of the ones that took us off that track. You, you son of a bitch, are one of the ones who ran us into the right-wing ditch! Respect? You want Barack Obama to respect you? Why don't you work on earning some of it, Chuck? And you have the nerve to quote the presidential oath of office to Barack Obama when for 8 years you've stood in blind, idiotic support of a man who referred to the Constitution of the United States of America as just a goddamn piece of paper? Gotta give you that much, Chuck. You got some brass. And by the way, I hate to remind you of this, Chuck, you obvious moron, but the Declaration of Independence is not law. It was never adopted as law into the Constitution. It is exactly what it says it is. It is a declaration. It isn't a law. You will limit the powers of federal government if you take this Constitution seriously. Well, Chuck, you dumbass, did you bother to read that preamble part about promote the general welfare? Reduce taxes, paren, for everyone, close paren. Oh, what's the matter with a Chucky? You afraid you're going to actually have to pay your fair share to be American, huh? Oh, such a poor baby. Encourage the freedom of religion and expression. Chuck, you're freely expressing pretty nicely there, buddy. You're dumber than a bag of handful homemade stupid. But nothing seems to be slowing you down. And stand up for such things as our right to arm bears. I mean, bear arms. Well, it doesn't look like the right to bear arms is under any kind of a significant threat. Lord knows you morons have run out and pumped more money into the gun industry in the last year than you have the rest of the economy probably in the rest of your miserable life. Sucker. The very fabric of our nation, the Declaration of Independence. Well, you're stupid, aren't you, Chuck? And by the way, that quote from Thomas Jefferson in 1809. The care of human life and happiness and not in their destruction, and not their destruction is the first and only legitimate object of good government. Chuck, buddy, hate to break it to you. That ain't about abortion. 1809. What was going on in 1809? Well, we had an America that was feeling rather expansive, that was looking west across the Mississippi into the Louisiana Purchase, that was about to go out and once again overrun the people who were here first, the first peoples, the Indians, for whom Thomas Jefferson actually maintained a somewhat solicitous attitude. That's why he told Lewis and Clark to be so very, 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 very careful in their expedition to not piss off the Indians. That's what he was talking about, preserving human life. He wasn't trying to tell some woman what she could or could not do with her own innards. You freak. Lead more from the center. By God, you weren't telling that to George W. Bush, now were you, Chuck? You were happy for him to be just to the right of Joseph damn Goebbels, weren't you, Chuck? But you've got a separate but equal standard for Mr. Obama, don't you, Chuck?
And that last paragraph, that threat,
we'll be watching you. This ain't Walker, Texas Ranger, Chuck. This ain't the movies, Chuck.
This is reality. And the reality is, you and your right-wing thug pals have done everything in your power to destroy this once great nation, and now you're out of power, and now it's time for you to learn your mantra for the next 4 to 8 years. It's 5 short words, Chuck. You can probably do it on the first take without requiring any sub. You won't even have to loop it. Here, say it with me, Chuck. Sit down and shut up. They ain't going away. And this isn't all there is. Yeah, too many kicks to the head. let's see who's on the phone. Hey, welcome to the program.
Man, I shouldn't say that. This is a habit of laziness, but the guy's an idiot. Man, is that guy stupid. Who gives this guy access to pens and paper?
All right. Really? Hey, who let Chuck play on the computer today? You know there's rules about letting Chuck on the computer.
Chuck, Ted Nugent, Tony Perkins. There's a lot of people that they should be punished in the respect that they should, like, lose their right to write stupid.
Interesting
like
you
that.
Should mention Ted.
Yeah, he's another one, isn't he?
Well, yeah, he is. Ted has also put his ideas out into the ether, so to speak. Let's see. How does Ted Nugent feel about Obama? Here, you want the quote?
No.
Too bad.
I was in Chicago last week, and I said, "Hey, Obama, you might want to suck on one of these, you punk." Obama, he's a piece of shit, and I told him to suck on one of my machine guns. Let's hear it for them. I was in New York, and I said, "Hey, Hillary, you might want to ride on one of these into the sunset, you worthless bitch. Since I'm in California, I'm going to find she might want to suck on my machine gun. Hey, Dianne Feinstein, run on one of these, you worthless whore. Any questions? Freedom!"
We need to get out into space, so not for nothing. There will be people like just deep six out of an airlock once in a while. Don't call me a fascist, but it's just taken out.
Hey, Ted, can you breathe vacuum?
Hey, Ted, give me another box of ammo. Where is it? Down to the vault to your right. Wait. Never hear you scream.
In space, no one can hear you scream.
Yeehaw.
In space, no one can hear you, wingnut.
Oh, God. I mean, you know, come on. What's up with the... You know, at least there's a Savage back on the airways we can be proud of. Have you seen Dan Savage just do some right wing?
Yeah, he kind of ate Tony Perkins' lunch, didn't he?
He did. He cracked Stephen Colbert. He made Stephen Colbert completely lose character. And that's a rare thing, because Colbert has the brass steelies to do that in front of the president and maintain. You know, he lost it. I mean, it's one of these things where, you know.
Well, he did, and they put him on Larry King Live opposite Tony Perkins. Norman! You know, from the Family Research Council. And he peeled Tony Perkins like a grape.
Well, Tony Perkins is a moron.
he's a former insurance hustler who does business with David Duke. What do you want?
You know, I'll tell you another thing, though. I just got to be real straight about it. And I love how, you know, while the voices will sit there and start trying to sing Kumbaya, you just don't give up with, you know, adding fuel to the fire, and because it's important, Bob, I'm going to start calling you the watchman. Because I'll tell you what, buddy, you know, you got dummies, and I'm telling you, he's a dummy. And I sat there and I had to check my mail and this and that, and you're not on in the morning, so I kind of had to put on the radio just to hear something, you know, to feed my mind.
Yeah, I understand.
There's Hartman, and he's sitting here. I know it's not prayer meeting, and I know your blood pressure's getting up there, but here we go. Hartman's railing about, and he's talking about alternative energies. Now, one of the things that bothers me about guys like Hartman, Tom Hartman, Thomas.
Yes.
Guys, you know, things that bother me about guys like that is, you know, I can agree with them 80% of the time, but the things I disagree with them on are as much as the things I disagree with Chuck Norris about. He's over here talking about capturing the carbon and out of coal, and just idiocy. You know what idiocy does to me? It makes me reboot.
I know.
And you know, he's talking about that. You know, and it's funny because you know, Tom Hartman's one of those guys who has dreams about going on a dinghy and wearing the little Greenpeace thing and being one of those, you know, whale pirates and stuff like that, protecting the whales and protecting the rainforest and all that other stuff. But you know what one of his solutions to our energy crisis is? And now this is just basic common sense. Maybe I'm just full of myself. I don't know. But he talks about, oh, well, we can, you know, lower tariffs on sugar and so on and so forth and buy sugar cane from Brazil. Now, Bob, without a doubt, there are economic holocausts going on in West Virginia. And West Virginia is not an isolated place in this respect. But there's also one going on in Brazil. And what is it in Brazil that we have that, man, it just is super fragile. It's on what? Like, it's got like an inch of topsoil or two of them at the most.
Yeah, the lungs of the planet. Yeah.
The lungs of the planet, something like that. Now, what are they sucking up of 50,000, 1,000, 100 acres a day? What is it? I don't even know the number. Whatever it is, it's too much. And they sit there, we need to give Brazil an excuse to cut down more rainforest and use coal. But yet, we're going to capture the CO2 and put it in a magic bottle that, you know, and it's just like one of these, just as there are on their side, there are
the Amazon rainforest is the carbon capture device. Oh damn, I know,
and it's and you know you got
I don't want anybody thinking I'm not gooning on Tom. I like Tom, and I know you do too. Nobody's going to agree 100% of the time, and frankly. There's a reason we're willing to rape Brazil. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, but it's just one of these things, and not for nothing. I'm not trying to say like that, but in a way, we should almost, in a sense, you know, send out some talking points. Because we can't have guys that are trying to talk about progressive anything and any, you know, green economy. You can't include a green economy with coal.
No.
Why the hell is that green? I mean, you know, wait. You know, and this is the thing that bothers me. You know, because Tom Hartman over here is a smart dude. All right? He knows a bunch of stuff. And why doesn't he, when I'm complaining about him a little bit, because it pisses me off most. Remember what we promised? We promised we're gonna hold both sides of the fire.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, people like Chuck Norris, they're just dead wood. You know, people like Chuck Norris and his fan base of that watches a show in Idaho that, you know, that teach their children to chant assassinate Obama on the school bus. You know, these people.
You're going through my stack for me, Albert.
Sorry, bud.
That's okay.
Outrageous.
I know, I'm kidding.
Oh, that's. Oh, when's 5 o'clock? But I mean, honestly, I mean, you know, we got to sit here and really kind of maybe just do some education. And I would love to, but his voicemail box is full, and he started talking about mortgages and all this other junk. So I just gave up. But honestly, you know, when we sit here looking at you know, a green economy, I can't even fathom how coal fits in the picture. It's like trying to go on a low fat diet and having, you know, bacon wrapped hot dogs and, you know, cheese filled hot dogs on a stick. I don't understand how you can imagine that this is something that's good to do. I don't understand how you can try to pretend like seriously.
I know. Just cheese filled hot dog on a stick. You got to be careful with what you do to me, Albert.
I know. All right. How about cheese wrap? Oh, you know what they got up here? We have this little They call them buzzard eggs. And what it is it's a little jalapeno and some cheese and some chicken, and they wrap it with bacon and fry them. They're called buzzard eggs. Man, they're pretty good.
But now my heart.
Yeah, they're good. And then they come with this, like, little lime. They call it mean green sauce. It's like a lime jalapeno vinegar sauce.
Oh, be still my heart.
I'll come up and visit, bud. I'll show you around. Anyway, we're sitting here looking at people like Thom, and he's over here. It's, I mean, he's got a brain, without a doubt. He's over here talking, because I think energy should be a church mantra. We really cannot let the argument of energy slip out of our grasp, period. We this is one thing that if we're going to sleep on anything, if anything's going to be put under our pillow, it has to be energy. You know, let the right-wingers go and buy their guns, you know, and they think, you know, Obama's going to come take them, which is just a joke. He's not going to come take them. It's like almost in a sense, I look at the gun issue as like, that's the Democrats' abortion issue. You know what I mean? It kind of, the whole gun rights and people don't want people to have guns and, you know, it kind of gets people to come out and vote and, it's kind of one of these things where it's a dead end, and they're not going to really do anything about it because it's really not worth the battle. It really isn't. I mean, I don't, you know, it's better to sit there and maybe, you know, maybe legislate gun safes or this or that. I mean, you know, kind of that kind of stuff. But to sit there and try to, oh, come and seize them, that would just be the most, that's like smoking in the powder room. You don't do it, you know, anyway. But, you know, to sit there and let these guys talk about coal and then capturing the carbon in a bottle and, what else is he blithering on about? Sugar cane and then, you know, and then corn. I mean, if you hear someone sit there try to talk to you about alternative energy, and you know we've had this conversation, but if they sit there, and this is for everybody, if somebody sits there and tries to tell you corn is a viable green fuel, you really got to just laugh at them. Because corn is a net energy loser.
Sure it is.
Period. It's a net energy loser. There are other crops. I'm not even going to get into it because you know how favorite it is mine. But there are other crops that we could do that will be a better supplement. Okay? Because, and he's right in terms of we need to get into electric vehicles. Oh, absolutely. You want to be in an electric vehicle. Everybody does.
I want a Tesla Roadster so bad I can taste it.
Oh,
if there was a dealership, I would go and lick the hood. I want one so bad.
Yeah, exactly. Now, everybody can have a Tesla Roadster once we start, you know, we got to save GM. And I didn't mention anything of this yesterday. It was prayer meeting. But we really need to, I mean, you know, they want to bail out. They need all this handout. Well.
No. I call BS on bailouts, all right? This is very serious stuff, Albert, and you recognize that. No more free lunches,
yeah.
Okay? I'm a Democrat. I'm a liberal. All right, but nobody's writing me checks. Nobody's writing you a check.
Nope.
And I understand that there is a complex interrelationship of parts suppliers and manufacturers, and there are good middle, what's left of middle class jobs involved. I agree with all of that. But you know what? If GM wants the money, then by God, the American people become shareholders.
And maybe we need a joint I hate to say this because it sounds so Maoist, but we need re-education camps.
I know.
I mean, but...
Well, no, not re-education camps. How about education schools?
Exactly. And, you know, we should have forums. You know, if we love to talk about democracy, well, let's have forums where people, I mean, that's one thing in terms of Venezuela. That's why I laugh every time I hear two people talk about how horrible, you know, Hugo Chavez is and all this other stuff. Because, you know, in Venezuela, the people come together and they have meetings and everybody gets to say their little piece. Now, here they have that too, but when are they? Who knows?
You know, every four years, the rest of the country just sort of stands slack-jawed staring at places like New Hampshire and Vermont and the idea of town meetings. I love that concept. You know,
yeah.
But you know, the rest of the country, well, nah, you know, I mean, wrestling's on. I can't go to no town meeting. You know,
well, just,
they, these people have never been to a town meeting. They don't know that it's more fun than wrestling.
Exactly.
It's fun. I mean, it's serious. It's earnest, serious business, and some of it's dull. You know, when are we going to pave the sidewalks? But you know what? Welcome to democracy.
Yeah. Well, tell you what, Bob, in terms of education, in terms of educating these, you know, our fellow citizens, how about these same people that go see wrestling? They'd be like, Richard Carl, what do I look like, a pinko? Do I look like some kind of limp wrist? It's like, and then you just got to sit there and look at them and give them a slap of reality. You know, an electric car will suck a VK Viper. It'll suck the life right out of it. You know how fast these electric cars are? Because that's, you know, that's one of these things. I think that's one of those angles that you can come at people and say, do you realize that Tesla Roadster, which Tesla, I just love the name. You know I love Tesla.
I know.
I'm gonna name if I have a son, I'm going to name him Nikolai. But I'm going to sit there and honestly, you know, if you sit there and see what that car would do to one of these, you know, an equivalent priced gas guzzler, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous how fast these cars are. Now, they're very expensive because, well, granted, they're not making very many of them, and there's a bunch of batteries involved and stuff like that. But,
yeah.
Man, I'll tell you what, if GM wants, you know, some assistance, now maybe we can have somebody pay somebody, you know, some overtime to go through these patent offices and start, you know, looking for battery technology or whatever else is buried in these places. Okay, maybe we could start doing this. And maybe we could start, you know, I don't know. You talk about these support facilities for GM. Well, Bud, I'll tell you what, there's a bunch of them around here. There's a bunch of them. In fact, the city of Janesville, which is it's a little bit ways away from me, it's closer to Madison and Milwaukee, but the city of Janesville basically lives by its GM plant. And its GM plant is now closing.
Right. And you know, you've just shown a light, Albert, on one of the problems that attends all this. Mono economies are by their very nature toxic. Whether it's a coal mono economy or a car building mono economy, any mono economy spells, you know, when times are good, they're very, very good. But when times get bad, they get worse than usual.
Yeah.
So
it's like a monoculture. Yeah, no, you're right. It goes even beyond the economy. I mean, look at it in terms of viruses that are coming out now, or the bacteria that, like staph and stuff like that, and all of a sudden now it's, you know, flesh eating.
Well, look, you know, Barack Obama took a bunch of hell last year for actually making some comments based on what he'd seen in the factory towns that were abandoned by corporate America. You know, I don't know if they forget or just weren't paying attention, or, you know, maybe I'm underestimating and people already know this. But Barack Obama was commenting on what happens to people in towns that have been abandoned by corporate America and their government.
Mm-hmm. No, they use them in their commercials now, Bob. Now they use them in their commercials to get their freaks to go out and get the guns. Have you heard them? Have you heard that commercial yet?
No, I'm living under a rock. No TV and no commercial radio. I'm gonna have to, with you on that. I'm gonna have to subject myself to some of this garbage just to stay in tune.
Yeah, no, they are. I mean, that's go look at the it's on the Crooks and Liars and the.
Come on down to the Western Gunsmiths Emporium. Our pre-Obama Day sale is going on now.
Oh, the gun shop, what was it called? Dirt Cheap Guns, whatever it was. Dirt Cheap Bargain Basement in Fort Worth, Texas. They have a picture of Obama on the freaking wall. And the guy has been saying, I've been making so many guns, I've been selling about $100,000 a day since the election. $100,000 a day since the election, but it could have been 2 to 3 times that if I would have had the stock inside the store.
Yeah, now see, there's the rub. You ever stop to wonder how they're doing this business? How was the inventory in place for all of this? Just, I mean, were they working double shifts at Smith & Wesson?
I'm not, fear's the mind killer. I'm not afraid of guns, you know. And I mean, I understand people are stupid, but, you know, I think cars sometimes scare me.
I'm afraid of a shotgun the way I'm afraid of a hammer, okay?
Kind of, exactly.
If you don't know how to use it, it can hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
And in the hands of a crazy person, they can kill you.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's... You're right. No, you're exactly right. I can admire that. I can sit there and look at it, at a gun like that or any kind of gun, and I can understand that. But, you know, when they're sitting there using, they're using it. They're using his words. They're using Barack Obama's words to make it sound like he's going to come get guns.
Right. But the upshot of what he was really saying, though, Albert, you know, that was a comment, and you know, we need to try to, you know, give this a little boost into the universe's ear. The reason he was talking about that stuff was not out of elitism or out of criticism or out of compassion.
That's right.
Because small town America is a beautiful thing. And small town America, you know, it wasn't a mysterious death. Small town America was killed by corporate America.
Yeah.
Because in most of those small towns, there were pre-existing infrastructures.
Mm-hmm.
Then the corporation comes in and everybody goes to work for the corporation at the plant. So the guy who was running the butcher shop shuts down the butcher shop and goes to work for the plant. Or his son, instead of coming into the family business, this is usually how it works, the butcher keeps butchering because there's people working and he can sell his goods, but his son goes to work at the plant instead of coming into the family butcher shop or bakery or whatever. And then there's nothing for that to be passed on to, so when Pops dies, butcher shop goes. Well, the plant's chugging along, and then you hear, "Well, we're facing an economic downturn, and we're going to have to go into layoffs." I mean, there's a town in Ohio. I don't have the name of it right at the tip of my tongue, but DHL, which incidentally John McCain owns stock in, just pulled up stakes.
Wasn't it Dayton?
I think it's near Dayton.
Yeah. Okay.
But they just pulled up stakes, and the town is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here in West Virginia, a few weeks ago, there was a trial down in Charleston in front of the federal judge about a mountaintop removal job that's going on in Clay County. Now, I'm not going to sit here and give you a detailed, there's not much detail to give about what Clay County is, except to say that it is destitute, it is pitiable. But it got a mountaintop removal job going in, and they brought in one of the county commissioners without disclosing him to our side, and just blindsided the court and us with this county commissioner who came in and said, "Well, it could be that they're poisoning our county. It could be that they're killing everything around us, but it's the only thing that's keeping Clay County alive, and we'll go bankrupt if you shut this here mine down."
Jesus.
And the federal judge, you know, what's he supposed to do? I mean, he's not a monster.
No.
He's a reasonable human being. And he's sitting there hearing this incontrovertible evidence from our side that everything that's going on there is pure, literal poison and a howling violation of the law. And then they bring this guy in to say, "Oh, but it's going to bankrupt us." Well, what's that judge supposed to do?
True.
You know, you can bust all Vulcan on him and say, "Well, hey, dumbass, your entire county is covered by something called the Central Appalachian Empowerment Zone, and the best thing you can think to do is blow up your mountains."
Exactly.
But he can't do that. I mean, this guy doesn't have to run for office. He's an appointee. But how are you supposed to just look askance at that and say, "Well, you know, die"?
Education. It's education. It has to be. I mean, because they're out of ideas when they're like that. You know, if you don't mind, there's a small painting I'd like to paint for you.
All right.
And it's regards to some of the research done by E.O. Wilson, you know, the famed botanist or whatever it is, the microbiologist, you know him? Anyhow, he studies ants.
Okay.
And he sits there and goes down, and they're checking out the leaf cutter ants, and they found something very interesting, you know, because a lot of them leaves down in the, you know, Amazon, you know, those plants, you know, have evolved because, you know, they have such a, you know, climate that they can. And one of the only things they do is a lot of them are poisonous, so they have toxicities that really you can't eat the leaves. And most of these plants that these leaf cutter ants go down there and they do this to, they basically bring these leaves down, it feeds it to a fungus, the fungus feeds the ants, and so on and so forth, and they live in this beautiful little harmony of symbiosis. Now, they have this symbiotic relationship, and they start studying them a little bit more, human beings. We're starting to look at them a little bit more. We say, what happens if we take the ants away from the fungus? And what we see is instantaneously that fungus dies. It turns green, it gets overwhelmed by other, you know, pathogens and dies. Now, they sat there and they put the ants together, it comes right back, right? You know, and they sit there and they show, like, what is this? Why is this happening? So they look at the ants, and out of the ants, you know, every ant has its job, and one of the jobs of these ants is to basically tend to this fungus. Now, they tend to this fungus, and they've been doing this for millions and millions and hundreds of millions of years, okay? Now, they do this, and they say, well, how does it, you know, they have to have some sort of antibiotic. I mean, they can't just pick clean every mold spore, you know, and bacteria. You know, ants aren't that sensitive. And what they see is they see this waxy buildup on the ant's chest that tend the fungus. And they sit there and they analyze it. And what they find is it's strains of hundreds of millions of different types of bacteria that act as antibiotic. And why I say that is that I believe that that is directly in relation to exactly what we're talking about here. This is in the sense, you know, why these big, giant, homogeneous type, just any type of culture, monocultures, when they sit there and we have this, I mean, all you're going to get on that is extinction. The bacteria and the fungus and the molds that get used to the antibiotics will evolve, adapt, and eventually kill that fungus. And once that fungus goes down, the whole colony goes down. You know, when we have everybody relying on GM, or coal, or anything like that, and if it happens to go down or run out or destroy our environment, well, you know where we are on that.
Yeah.
Now, I believe that there's a better way, and I believe in this way that we can do this, and I think it's apparent. I think it's self-apparent. We have to break these big, giant trusts up, okay? We have to sit there and break these monopolies up. These things have to get broken down. They cannot be any kind of monopoly. We have to be a little bit more flexible, like chain mail or something along those lines, where one failure isn't going to completely destroy everything, which is what you're seeing now. I mean, you know, when people sit there and they lose the ability, you know, and it's their greed. Everybody gets, you know, it's easy to get sucked into evil. But, you know, we sit there and everybody, you know, they mortgage out because they want to have this and they want marble countertops or whatever and they want a new vehicle. You know, well, that's great for, you know, we talked about this about years and years ago, and now here we are hitting into it. You know, we're sitting there looking at this problem and, you know, the answer is right in front of us. It's simply right in front of us. We know what we need to do. We need to become more sustainable. We need to be more diversified. We have to be able to, like, you know, create brand new markets of, you know, things that aren't going to be just spreading toxins. It's just one of these things that
people like Van Jones are out there and they're working. Are you familiar with him?
Van Jones, no.
Yeah. You'll be glad.
It's a matter
of rethinking. You know, it's great. The Wealth of Nations comes out in 1776, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of charts this roadmap for how things are going to go as technology increases, and it's used as the roadmap by which we've done everything we've done so far. But the right wing wants to believe there's capitalism. And then Karl Marx comes along and writes the Communist Manifesto, and that's another way of thinking about things. That's all these are, different ways of thinking about going about the business of being human.
Exactly.
Well, we've got what you're talking about in its very essence, Albert, is trying to come up with another way of going about the business of being us. We're talking about communities that aren't tied. Look, this stuff can be charted. It's not just, you know, in a vacuum. We started a war. Well, first of all, we had a surplus, and we gave that away to people who didn't need the money.
True.
Then we started a war that we couldn't afford, and we did it on hot checks and credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, that caught up with us. Because at the same time here at home, we were bolstering all this stuff with phony baloney financial products that had no real value. You know, if you can't measure it, if you can't weigh it, if you can't put it, then sooner or later it doesn't have value.
Mm-hmm.
So those things caught up, then the phony baloney mortgage crisis kicked in. And now we find ourselves where we are, and lo and behold, even if a town's got three or four plants in it, they're all looking at going belly up.
That's right. Well, why? They're only making one kind of vehicle at these plants. They're making one vehicle. What? Wait.
Or they make one widget, or they make the widget for one vehicle.
Exactly. And it's like, I don't understand it. I don't understand how... I mean, it's just pure stupidity. If you look at the ants, there's a reason they have 100 million different types of antibiotics on their chest. Because they always need to have new avenues.
Oh, look, are you talking, oh, dear God, I think you're talking about evolution, aren't you?
Oh, what's that? Oh, that doesn't exist.
Oh, ants of the devil. This is what you have when you spend 8 years letting people run things who don't believe in the natural world around them, who live in some sort of Tinkerbell pixie dust world.
Seriously.
I mean, Jesus Christ, the Paris Hilton has just released a new perfume called Fairy Dust, and I think the entire right wing has been doused in the stuff. you've engendered a couple of good emails here. Our pal Marty in California writes in, and he says, first of all, I'd rather have a Lotus Turbo Esprit, only they're not being manufactured anymore. Well, I understand that because, I still have a passion for Porsche. But I think Porsche will come up with something like the Tesla soon enough, and then I'll be really happy.
Exactly. You can still throw an electric engine in it.
Yeah. But Marty says, I heard the same show, and I think Albert's incorrect. He said, if memory serves, Tom was talking about the so-called carbon cap and trade system. I don't think Albert heard all of the conversation. Tom did speak of the cane sugar being grown in Brazil, but he was talking about it in terms of flex fuel system cars that are manufactured. He said, anyway, just my recollections. So that's that.
Well, true, but he was also talking about us using, you know, flex fuel or not. I mean, something that can sit there and burn ethanol or methanol and gasoline. It's just one of these, you know, yeah, all right, we want to lower how much, you know, crude oil we consume. Right?
And the net lowering of that crude oil is important, but we're not making any strides forward if we replace the crude oil by being reliant upon some other country's ability to produce something else, even if it is more sustainable and renewable, because we have monstrous appetites in this country, Albert.
Yeah. Well, in the whole world. Look at China. They're just starting to get hungry.
Yeah. So then William just wrote in, and he says, what escapes me about using crops is where the hell's the water going to come from? I'm all for alternate fuels, but it seems to me water will run out before the stinking oil. Mountaintop removal, polluting most of the water alone with everything else we dump into it. He says, Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, I was just going to say, water is on a cycle. It's certainly going to the ground, but it also will evaporate. And putting the plants in doesn't, you know, a forest, just because it rains and this and that and the water goes into the ground doesn't mean it doesn't also, you know, expire some water as it, you know, just grows and actually attracts more water to its area, you know, and raises the humidity overall. I mean, if we can use water intelligently. I mean, granted, using water the way we do.
But it has to be there to use it. When we were, when Michael and Jen were here last week and we were doing some shooting video-wise, Michael and I walked up on a hilltop to get a better look at what they're doing here close to home. And, you know, it's autumn in the mountains. And honest to God, it was like walking through a snow of leaves. Because the leaves on the mountain, on the mountainside, were a foot thick, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just stopped. Not that I was playing tour guide or anything, but you know, I was having these little epiphanies and I wanted to share them. And I said, the topsoil on this hill is not that thick. It's not very thick at all. And I pointed out a couple of hardwoods around there. I said, look at the root systems on these things. Because they, you know, they had their knees up above the ground almost like cypresses in a swamp above the water. I said, the reason those knees are up there is because they can't get down through the stone below.
That's right.
Because there's not that much soil. But those falling leaves are what rots and compacts and produces the soil. And all the, you know, that whole area was largely clear cut in 100 years ago. And this is what's come back, and the soil depth that you have is what's come back. But that little bit of soil can absorb enough water to provide all the life that's on that mountain. But when you blow it away, when the rain falls, it hits, it bounces, literally. There's no topsoil to absorb it, and it runs away. And then it goes exactly into that cycle you just mentioned, where you've got much more expiration, much more evaporation, and you wind up with a net loss. Whereas when it goes into the soil, it filters down through the stone, it goes into the aquifers, and it is retained for future use and finds its way into the hydrologic system in a much slower and more orderly process.
Exactly. Well, it's more of a cycle then. I mean, it's a better cycle than, you know, using that water to wash coal tar sands or using that water to heat the earth so they can, you know, pull oil out of shale, because that's where we're going. You know, I mean, that's where we're headed, people, everybody. You know, wake up. You know, oil is running out. I don't care if it, you know, a little bit of a depression makes it last another 5 years. I mean, we're going to hit the peak here. I mean, in our lifetime, okay? The peak will come before Jesus does. Okay, so this is something that we need to plan for. And we can either choose to do things on a macro level, on something where we play more of a symbiotic relationship. We don't have this monoculture. We have this huge biodiversity and this huge just economic diversity. And we have to use our resources in a smarter way. I would personally rather use our resources on crops that, you know, like hemp, or any of these other crops. I would rather use it on crops than washing out coal tar sands. And
well, hear, hear.
You know, I mean, if we're going to sit here, it's here. We got to use it. I'd rather use that than that. I'd rather crack hydrogen out of it, hydrogen and oxygen out of it, you know. And there's many different ways to do that, you know. Enough solar panels generates electricity, and that electricity can crack hydrogen. I mean, crack hydrogen out of water. So, I mean, and then when we burn it, it turns right back into water. So, I mean, you know, I understand in terms of water, and I know people have been beating on that drum for a while, but, you know, we're going to have to figure out a lot of ways to do things, but if we don't make that next step away from the old way of doing things.
Right, that's exactly what you're saying. You know, William writes here, he says, I don't like the idea of bailing out the big three. Screw them. They've had decades to improve the crap they've been pumping out. In the 70s, when there were even odd days, they all went to small cars and then brought back the big gas hogs without pause because that's what sold. Then they made their profits and could have retooled but they did it all based on old internal combustion engines, and now they need help to retool again. They screwed up. Let them fix it. Dig into their own damn pockets or fail just like any business would if they took the wrong path. They claim to be too big to fail, but they only got big because of the workers that once again they screwed over without regard or conscience. To have new sources of fuel, water cannot be involved. They just don't have the answers, and now is not the time to test things by using more natural resources.
Amen. 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 Hallelujah. Let them fail, and then, you know, let somebody else, let Tesla. I mean, Tesla came out with a thing, okay? They came out with this concept. You know, I think Arnold Schwarzenegger, I know that they've been having some problems lately because mostly their vehicle is a little too expensive. I mean, but there's other, you know, they can, you know, with the right investments in terms of government investments in batteries and government, you know, tax credits, give these guys some tax credits. Let Tesla become the next GM. Let somebody new step to the plate. If somebody like GM and Chrysler and Ford are going to fail, well, they fail. That's the old, let's get a new one for the new century. I don't know.
And, you know, we've talked about this in the past, Albert. Look, Henry Ford succeeded because there were others around him who were persisting in doing the same old tired stuff. Well, they're always going to need Conestoga wagons.
We're always going to need coal.
Yeah.
We're always going to need penicillin. We're always going to need, you know, it goes on and on. We're always going to need a heavy-duty military-industrial complex.
Yeah, but William also identifies something else, and that is, no bailout unless I see CEOs and shareholders writing checks, too.
Mm.
For instance, and I don't know what the numbers are. They're not at my hand. But unless something has changed dramatically in the last few years, GM owned a massive share. It was a minority share, but it was a massive minority share of Toyota.
Yeah.
Now, how do we handle something like that? I don't know if they still do, but Chrysler used to own a humongous chunk of Mitsubishi, and Ford owned a humongous chunk of Mazda. Now, how does that play into this? You know, and there's a labor issue in here, too, because you see, what'll happen now, and this pisses me off righteously, what'll happen now is that GM will leverage the United Auto Workers. And they'll say, well, you know, you've got to contact your congressman. We've got to have a bailout, you know. And basically they're telling, and at some point they'll tell the UAW, you know, pay cuts. Remember what, we're going to bail out GM when GM was actively involved in screwing, what was the name of the company a couple of years ago, Albert? Screwed them to the wall, people making $20 an hour, $27 an hour, told them they wanted to work for $9. And I'm supposed to bail out that kind of behavior?
Exactly. Yeah, I remember that I remember that now. I totally remember. Yeah, Bob, you got a long memory too, bud. We almost forgot all about that one. Yikes.
But I'm not gonna, because that's what that amounts to. That would be subsidizing the absolutely predatory behavior that GM engaged in with regard to its own workers, and now they're gonna cry to their worry, well, you've gotta save us or you won't have a job. God, I wish, how I wish the Reuther brothers were still around, because those men had the stones to sit there at that table and look at the chairman of GM, Delphi. There we go. Remember Delphi?
Delphi, exactly. There we go. Yep. I see. I can see its label right now.
You know, but the Reuthers would look at him and say, tell you what, you want us to do this? It's going to cost you. And, you know, the cost isn't in dollars. The cost is in terms of how you go about doing business.
Yeah.
During the automotive crisis of the 70s, everybody looked at the Japanese and said, well, look how they run their companies. And lo and behold, they had, and I'm sure Robert in Japan can probably straighten me up some on this, but they had a business model that said that the guy who welded who did the welds was as important as the guy, the CFO of the corporation.
Yes. They made all their parts to tighter specifications in terms of, within a certain fault line, and they made their vehicles better. They just made them better. They tightened it up. They improved manufacturing, you know, and they could make them smaller, and they were more fuel efficient, and it because of crumples. I mean, you ever sit there and look at what a car, if you want to go see a video, you go look at what the French did with that little, it's ugly little thing. It looks like an egg. I actually saw one driving down my road. It's called one of them smart cars.
Yeah.
Right? They're big in Europe, and they're cheap. You look at this little egg thing, this ugly little thing, and it's doing 75 miles an hour, and they basically slam it into a 60-degree wall. I mean, just hammer this way. Probably even less than that. Probably, I don't even know. Right? Just almost a vertical, but it slid along. This thing hit this this little car hit this wall so hard, I thought it was going to blow up into a billion pieces. It slides down the way. Next thing you know, they can open the door and they can close it. The internals of the cab are completely safe and completely solid. You don't need 15 tons of steel in order to keep the passengers safe. Okay, I mean, you need to use your brain, crumple zones and this and that, and all these other kinds of structural integrities and all these heavy-duty materials. I mean, these are the kinds of things we need to be looking at and focusing on, and not this nonsense. Not letting, you know, when GM, you say that, and you know that brings up my bile and my gut to hear GM with their, they're cannibals, they're predators. These people, we need to shut them out. They need to be gone. We need to get rid of that old way of thinking. We need to get rid of the Walmarts of the world. Okay? How much longer are we going to be dealing with this crap with Walmart? Walmart can't sustain itself in this kind of, you know, they keep turning a profit because that's how everybody keeps turning to it because it's so, you know, this Chinese labor crap. But, you know, China's economy is starting to show signs of cracks too.
Didn't they just have to do some sort of financial mumbo jumbo with their currency recently?
Yeah, and you see how well that worked for us, right?
I know. But you know, this is all interconnected. It's not linear. That's, you know, maybe that's one of the things that we do well here is we point out the web nature of all of this. And you know, I talk about consumer choices being moral choices and ethical choices. We went over that list last night of all these Mormon-controlled businesses.
Yep.
Well, try this one on. Try this one on for size. What do you do if your choice is, let's say, buying a computer from Dell, which, being a Mormon-owned business, is actively involved in the future theocratic takeover of this country?
Mm-hmm.
Or buying a computer from some company that made it with Chinese slave labor. What do you do? I know. But you get the point.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. And in a sense, every time you buy, no matter what, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you give your money to one, you know, you're screwed. And if you give it to another, you're screwing somebody else. And, you know, I think we're coming to that point. I hope we're coming to that point, Bob. I really do. I really hope that my children never have to worry about making a choice like this. And, I mean, we're coming to a point, I hope, where people will literally, you know, as they open their eyes and they keep, you know, they will open their eyes to new subjects, and they'll sit there and they'll go, man, I don't want, you don't even have to go to computer parts. Look at coffee.
Yeah.
Look at coffee and what that does. I mean, look at slave labor and crap like that. You know, why would you want to put your dollars into that? Why would you want to sit there and, you know, support these things?
Well, and, you know, there's the obvious answer to my hypothetical in the chat room. Dave just said, buy a Mac.
No, you can't. The same thing. Who do you think makes the internals for that? Same companies. It's the same. And that's the thing. We're becoming this big monoculture. It's becoming the corporation. Freaking Brando. It's becoming like that. It's getting to be Carl's Jr. It's, I mean, you know, Dell. Well, Michael Dell is a right-wing Christian. I don't think he's a Mormon. I know he's I'm pretty sure he's an evangelical, okay? Well, he's in business with the Mormons. Okay, now that's on that front. If you sit there and you look, Apple, man, Intel makes Apple's crap, okay? It's diffused, and I'm pretty sure that's diffused in Malaysia or one of these places. They probably pay their people a little bit, but whatever. I mean, anything. There is no ethical choices in that respect in terms of technology. Here's the real big question. What do you do with it when it's done? Where do you throw it? Where are you going to throw it? You're going to put it in the garbage? You know how many toxins are in these things? And speaking of Mac, speaking of toxins, speaking of this kind of garbage, the scientist in some lab sat there and he had his little Mac and he smelled this weird smell coming off of it. And it's probably not, you know, it's definitely not exclusive to Macs. However, he goes and he sits there and takes his little, you know, data, you know, Star Trek sniffer thing, and he analyzes the gases coming off of it, and it's benzene.
Well, how do you do?
Yeah, how do you like that?
News Ninja Gene chimes in and says, you find a local white box maker. You build your own. Granted, you still have the Chinese slave labor for the parts, but at least you have your own work.
I agree, Gene. I agree.
And you know, that's what we've done here.
Well, that's it's what you got to do. And hopefully what we can do now, though, is, you know, people have to wake up. People have to sit there. I mean, it comes to a simple choice in terms of saying, you know, we are not going to stand. I mean, if we don't, and I know how this argument comes and goes. It wanes and, you know, it back and forth is the whole, it's the sweatshops. You know, just because you don't hear about sweatshops anymore, just because Kathy Lee Gifford's off the target or because she's not using it anymore, doesn't mean it's still not happening. You know, I mean, we sit there and you think there isn't, I don't think there's a single thing. There's actually very few things. And I know you've tried to expose that to people over the years with No Sweat and, you know, other types of clothing brands and, you know, food brands. And there's all these, there are union-made things that, you know, don't just go around raping people, and that's how they make their, you know, their bottom dollar. But, you know, maybe there should be some sort of limitations to the market in terms of who can put their money involved, in terms of dividends, or in terms of all kinds of other things. I mean, when we sit here and look at how, I know this is going to piss people off, but you know what? We can't have our cake and eat it too. There are going to have to be sacrifices. We cannot sit here and use one thing constantly because it's going to ensure our death. It is. I mean, we're going to use up resources faster. Why? And if we use up resources faster, oh, wait, that's right. Here we are at wars with countries and invading countries over what? We all know what the hell we're in Iraq for.
What's our oil doing under their sand?
Exactly. I mean, we're either there for oil or we're there for some, you know,
society
crap.
You mentioned coffee a minute ago. And I can't let that run by without getting a plug in for a really good fella. Of course, I heard him listening to Nova M, and I'm, you know, this is not paid or anything like that, but I know he does. I've had his coffee and it's really good stuff. You want to do the right thing coffee wise, you go to superbeans.com.
You go to Superbeans.
Yeah.
Yep. No
and,
doubt.
And
you
know
him.
You know what you're getting. You know where it's coming from. I mean, I can't pick up a thing of Maxwell House in the grocery store without a shudder running through my body anymore, or Folgers,
yeah,
or any of that stuff, because I know what's happening to the people who are growing that stuff.
You've seen Black Gold?
Yeah.
Have you seen that? Yeah. Oh, everybody, go watch it. Go watch it. Go download it. Information. Go see it. Watch that, and then that will change your life. That movie will. I can't walk down the aisle if it's got Folgers in it. I just can't. Where are tomorrow's terrorists going to come from, Bob? You know, if we finally appease this energy thing, we're still raping people over food.
As long as we're content for others to starve so that we can be obese, we got a problem. Now, this is not everyone must be a peasant to be pure, you know, bull.
But there are ways
to manage the planet that make sure that nobody, no child goes to bed with a rumbling belly. And by the way, I conjured Robert in Japan, or we conjured Robert in Japan, Albert.
All right.
He says, yes, the Japanese car companies would be a bit different. One difference is that the CEOs only made 14 times more than the worker. Not 140 times the rate of American CEOs compared to their workers. Also, there was lifetime employment, and this meant during a recession and really hard times, workers weren't tossed out. But he says, Bob, this has changed, and more contract workers are the norm. In fact, I heard from one part-time worker here who lives in Yahata, most of the contract workers for the car companies have been laid off. So he said that the lunch boxes, the bentos, are down 50% in the area. Just one knockdown effect. Also, another down point in Japanese car companies is that workers work far too long. There's a lot wrong about Japanese companies, but this can be fixed immediately by the right labor decisions, by the right people in unions and the government. It just requires willpower. But in the long run, it's still a more sustainable model, and like Robert says, all you got to do is tinker a little bit.
Exactly. Well, I mean, it looks to me like if we don't do something different, right, even with the Japanese, look what's going on with them. If we don't do something different, we're all going to be peasants anyway. We're all going to be owned. We're all going to have lords, and we're going to be serfs. I mean, we're going to be, you know, living on borrowed time. I mean, we can't, you look at France, look at Germany. I mean, even Germany's economy is getting hit. But Germany, one of the nice things about Germany Not that I'm not even German, but one of the nice things about it is they still have a manufacturing sector. You know, like Audi and, you know, Volkswagen, and, you know, they still make things.
Porsche.
They make Bosch, and well, that's Audi. That's all Audi. I mean, Volkswagen, now you talk about a big thing. You know, that's one of those things. Did you know that Volkswagen owns Lamborghini and Bugatti and Porsche and Audi? And, I mean, and there's another couple of them that it has.
Oh, yeah.
And now,
long ago in the dim, far mists of time, it came as a complete surprise to me. I had purchased a little Porsche 944. Oh, I was so proud of her. And I was learning to do my maintenance and everything, being a good Porsche owner. And I crawled underneath, and I was just looking around, and I saw the Fauve stamp on the engine block, and I went, well, bless my soul. And, what a car. That thing had cylinders in it like the size of coffee cans. It was a beautiful thing. God, I loved it. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
We can still have fun. We can still eat food. But everybody else can, too. I mean, I think there's enough on this planet to go around. I do. I mean, you know, I don't think we need to go into these other countries and buy water rights. So that, like, they don't even own the rain that falls down on their heads. You know, I don't think we can sit there and look at more ways to rape and pillage. You know, like, we have this Viking mentality when it comes to economic growth, and it's just not a sustainable way to be.
Beautiful. Viking mentality. That's just beautiful. Cindy just wrote in, Albert. We've apparently lit a little candle this evening.
Oh, excellent.
She says, I won't prattle on about how GM bought up the public transit system of Los Angeles back in the 30s and 40s and put it to death to replace it with billions of cars spewing gasoline and profit. And I won't go on about how GM redneck workers voted for Bush and never, ever supported nationalized medicine and actually fought Hillary when she tried to install it. I'll just say this. What American will buy their product if they built it with stolen dollars from our children's children? Whoa.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, amen. I mean, we need to start, you know, if we're going to assimilate cultures, we should learn from them, you know, and the peoples, the first, how you started it off tonight, you know, talking about the First Nation peoples and, you know, how that is all connected with us. You know, those people were pretty smart. You know, they knew how to live with the land. They didn't get overpopulated and they didn't destroy all their buffalo. And I'm not trying to say everybody's got to grow dreadlocks and eat, you know, bean sprouts. But,
which ain't a bad idea. I mean, I like bean sprouts.
Which, I do, too.
I bought tofu today. I'm so proud of myself. I bought tofu today.
Tofu. It depends. It depends on how it's made. But I don't know. Anyway.
I know. No, trust me. I'll do something yummy with it. Yeah, but you started down this road with the Amazon, and I recall... You know, I read some of these books, and lately I can't afford books. So the ones that I have, I reread. And I've got a book by Charles C. Mann, I believe. It is called 1491. And it's a survey of the current understanding as of about 2 or 3 or 4 years ago of the world the year before, the new world the year before Columbus arrived. And one of the things that they discovered, and I haven't seen much of it out in the popular press, but it is just mind-boggling in its scope, is that little tiny skin of dirt in the Amazon rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
You ever pick up a handful of potting soil and you see those little tiny white styrofoam beads that are added into it for aeration purposes?
Yep.
Well, it turns out the vast majority of the soil surface in Amazonia is like that.
Yeah.
It is man-made topsoil.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the conventional science said, well, you know, there were nothing here but barbarian savages. Wow. And that is a backhanded, really cheap, racist way of saying it's okay for us to kill them and take it away.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that soil is just everywhere they dug, that soil was full of pot sherds, Albert.
Oh, yeah, I've read about this.
Broken clay pottery, and once you started pulling the liana and the vines and all of that stuff away, there were orchards.
Wait a minute. it's in my National Geographic. He's talking about dirt.
And so when we contemplate this stuff, there's a lot of hubris. There's a lot of intellectual hubris. It goes back, some forward thinking inventor types invented that KISS theory sometime back. You know, keep it simple, stupid.
That's right.
As a way of saying, you know. Well, anybody who's ever seen one of those beautiful Rube Goldberg machine cartoons, for lighting a cigar, and it's this room full of things and chains and levers and pulleys, and then the match strikes the slate and boom, lights the cigar. Well, that's what we're doing.
Exactly.
Forests are carbon capture devices. We're talking about cap and trade plans. You know, I was at the Society of Environmental Journalists meeting a few weeks back. And I looked down in my swag bag, and I found this red cap, courtesy of the Natural Resources Defense Fund, or the Environmental Defense Fund. Can't remember which. But on the front, it just says, just cap it. In other words, no cap and trade. Cap it.
Yeah.
Stop with the emissions. Find ways not to do it.
Exactly.
Because as long as we're talking about sequestering carbon and trading carbon, there's one thing that is still, by God, for sure happening. We're pumping it into the atmosphere, into the water, and into the ground. And I'm sorry, rivers aren't supposed to fizz like a Pepsi.
Or burn.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Albert, I'm going to roll on, brother, but this has been a darn fine one.
You know I love it. I'll talk with you. You be good. So I'll give my love to everybody, and I look forward to everything else.
All right. Take care, man.
Always. Be good. Bye-bye.
All right. A couple of emails to hit before I do roll on to the next call. And lines are open, by the way, if you want to jump in. 304-658-3333 or toll-free 877-443-2366. That's 877, the numeral 4, head on. Just to sort of back up and hit some of the stuff that was rolling in during that conversation. David in Tennessee says, getting back to Chuck Norris for a minute, you think maybe it's not Norris that Obama should worry about? Maybe it's the guy that says, I know about this. This is Chuck telling me to armor up. You know, Bob. Like that backup center down Texas Longhorn Way, Buck Burnett, who wrote on his Facebook page, gather up, hunters. We got a in the White House. Then David adds, oh, but not to worry. The Secret Service, carrying egalitarian unit that it is on the job and eager to protect. Yeah, that's why they named him Renegade. talking about China's economy, as an indicator, God, you guys follow this stuff so well. As an indicator, the three main scrap metals price, iron, copper, and aluminum, has dropped approximately 60% in the last 30 days. Why? China is 50% of the world's market for the scrap and has essentially not bought enough to matter for 60 days. Oopsie. Worldwide what on the way? Yeah, we know what the what is. And says, as far as the American lifestyle is concerned, you and Albert don't understand. The U.S.? Live a little differently? Never. Five Deaf Dick has told you how it is several times. Listen up, liberal. The American lifestyle is not negotiable. That's the thing, though. Who's American lifestyle? We have our faults here. But we're not living really heavily. We tend to make things last as best we can. Robert says, Albert's starting a lot of ideas rolling here, but one of the new industries here in Kitakyushu, an old coal mining and steel industry city, is that of recycling old manufacturing waste. Old refrigerators, cars, computers are broken down into component parts and made into neat new stuff. We have a huge technopark across my university next to our port. And the good thing, Bob, is that it cannot be outsourced. The waste is here, not in China, and there's no way for China to get at this industry. Maybe that's part of the future. As far as German manufacturing is concerned, David adds, in the last year for which numbers are available, 2007, Germany had a positive balance of trade, some $280 billion. That old Europe may have a good idea or two left in it. By the way, tofu lasagna. Drop the ricotta and add crushed red pepper and olive oil. That, by George, sounds good. Well, it was on special, so I got two big bricks of extra firm, one brick of firm, and one brick of silken. I'm going to try to use the silken to make, like, tofu berry fruit smoothies for the kids and see how that comes off. We'll sweeten it with honey and see if they are amenable to it. Finally, also from William, one enormous tapeworm who sucks the resources from any country it can, and when done, leaves the tapeworm segments behind to continue the process of eating away, describing the United States economy as being rather parasitic. The U.S. war machine is the tapeworm, and the depleted uranium and landmines are the segments left behind. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And we enable that how? And for what reason? Yeah, exactly. Hey, welcome to the program.
Me again?
Hey, Dave, what's up?
you got onto subjects that, like, are really close to me, you know. I've been frantically typing while listening, you know, just making a list so that hopefully I don't forget too much. Going way back to the subject of bugs and ants and things, I can't remember who came up with this, but somebody said that if every insect on the planet was to disappear tomorrow, there would be no life on it within 50 years. If every human was to disappear tomorrow, life would flourish. So, who's important here?
Right, we've got a little bit of a twisted look at twisted perspective on what constitutes life.
Everything is so tightly interconnected. You can't mess with one bit without messing with the whole thing. You know. Unfortunately, there are too many people is a big problem, and I don't know how you get around that one, because for me to start interfering with people's reproductive rights is a bad move. It's just basically not the thing to do. The interesting thing being, however, that when people have health care and there's a 98% chance that their kids are going to survive into adulthood and have kids themselves, they have less kids. And
yes.
So when people say, you know, well, you can't kind of give people health care, there's already too many people, that actually is a stupid argument because it actually helps the whole deal. People have 12 kids because that's the only way two of them are going to survive, just like fish lay a million eggs because that's the only way two of them are going to survive. You know, evolution does this. It makes things work. The problem is that humans have kind of started tinkering with that, but. You know, you can see what I'm saying here.
Absolutely.
You know, and the thing is that if you were to go to Africa, I mean, Africa has been so badly screwed by everybody for so, so long. I mean, the Brits have so much to answer for there.
Yeah, but so do the Belgians and the Germans and the French. And I mean,
oh, yeah, I mean, the whole empire thing. But that's the corporate monster at work. If you can't get what you want here, go somewhere else and steal it. And at some point, the corporate monster is going to run into a problem. There's going to be no cheap labor left on the planet.
Well, I don't necessarily buy the idea that there will be no cheap labor left on the planet, because the way they've got it dummied up, Dave,
well,
is
that was nice simplistic.
Yeah, there will always be cheap labor left. It's just that they're going to rotate where the cheap labor is.
Well, what I was going to say was that cheap labor can be created. Like you were talking earlier about, you know, the Union of Auto Workers. that GM are going to say, well, you're going to lose your jobs if we don't get a bailout. That's the kind of approach that leads to all of this. You know, divide and conquer. Just get these guys lined up and say, you're going to lose out if you don't make everybody else lose out. And it's that making small groups fight each other. And people have got to really see this because the world is in a really bad state right now. There are so many threats. And there's all this stuff about money right now, the financial stuff. It's pocket change compared to the cost of environmental degradation. I mean, the services that people would get from an environment that was taken care of make this banking stuff, the value of it, make this bank stuff look like nothing. So the environment is the issue for me. It really is. I mean, I get really...
Well, and I think you're spot on, Dave, because, among other things, for instance, we spend millions of dollars, and I am not begrudging the millions that we spend, trying to, A, sort out the cause of, and B, then cure cancer.
Well, my approach
But we've focused, for instance, on say lung cancer. Well, you know, quit smoking. Skin cancer, melanoma. Quit standing under the blazing sun.
Well,
okay,
not quit.
But that's
just calm it down lots.
But
you know?
but the thing is
vitamin D.
But we keep avoiding larger causes. How many brilliant people have we lost to other forms of cancer? I'm not saying that smoking is not a problem or not a cause. It most assuredly is. And exposure to the sun is a clear cause of skin cancers. However, what we've done to our planet has led to the uptick in skin cancer. And what's been done to the tobacco chemically has led to the uptick in lung cancer. The focus is too narrow.
We're looking at curing rather than preventing. And that's where the corporate monster comes in. They make money from people's illness.
Yeah.
So they don't care about preventing cancer. They care about selling you the drugs to cure it or to extend your life once you've got it. Cancer is something that's really close to me. I lost my nephew 2 years ago to cancer. And so for me, it's something, and one of the things that I say to my kids is, what's the best approach with this? Prevent it. Don't try and cure it once it's happened. You get much better results by preventing it happening, by reducing the amount of things like estrogen mimics
phytoestrogens.
In the environment, et cetera. You know, there's so many. I don't want to get into a list, but PCBs, blah, 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 blah. The list is way too long. You know?
Literally, the Potomac River, the Potomac River runs its to its source in the eastern highlands of West Virginia, Dave. And the biologists have found that literally the phytoestrogens coming from the fertilizers and the pesticides that are running off into the river are leading to a transgenderization of the fish.
And frogs are all sprouting extra limbs and, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah, it's all the three-eyed fish from the intro to the Simpsons, exactly.
The services we get from, shall we just use the term Mother Nature for want of a better term, the services we get from Mother Nature are so enormous. How could we do anything to damage our mother? I'm an atheist. I'm not a spiritual person, but that's the best way I can put it.
I understand completely, but look at the way that we have framed Western civilization. Western civilization has been framed from at least 1000 AD forward and as the battle for civilization beating back the wilderness and the depredations of a cold and calculating cruel nature. as if it was as if the planet was something to be beaten into submission. And it's this failure, Dave, our failure to comprehend that we are part of a symbiotic whole that threatens human existence on the planet.
Yeah, well,
you don't play. You don't play within the rules of the game.
Failing.
The game will take you out.
Yeah, this, you know, this was in 1967, the Six Days War. I was 12. I was at school, and you know, you'd hear the radio before you went to school in the morning. You'd watch the news when you came home from school at night, and all I kept hearing was that the terrible threat about the possibilities for this oil stuff was that economies wouldn't grow. And I can distinctly remember coming home from school one night, and my dad had just come in from work, and I said, you know, I keep hearing all this stuff, and something that I really can't get hold of here is that these guys are talking about economies have to grow, but the Earth's not getting any bigger, so one day this has to stop. Now that was in 1967 I said that, and I distinctly remember it, and so does my dad. And I've seen that for so long that I've kind of tried to frame my life within that. And I try and live close to where I work, combine journeys, all that kind of stuff. Not because I gain by it, but because everybody gains by it. I can't bring myself to do something that is going to damage someone else if I can minimize it. I try and make that a core part of my life. And if everybody did that, woohoo, I think the world would be really nice.
You know, you remind me, as did Albert, with the way the discussion is going forward, of the brief portion of the presentation that I heard over at Society of Environmental Journalists by the author of the book, What Women Really Want, I think, or something like that was the title. But he pointed out a statistic that when women are in control of their own reproductive decisions, in virtually every culture where that is the case, overpopulation does not happen.
Exactly. I mean, there's countries in Europe where they're almost giving people tax break to have kids, and that's just because the corporate monster needs more bodies, you know.
Right. You can look here in North America, since I mentioned 1491, the Shawnee people.
Yeah.
The Shawnee people had a structure whereby they had a male and a female chief in any given social group. And before the males could go off to war, they had to have the permission from the female, who was the peace chief, if I understand the history correctly.
Sounds like a great idea to me.
And what's more, Because they had a rather profound understanding of exactly what they could and could not tolerate in terms of maintaining their culture, the women maintained strict population levels.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure some right winger would say, well, they didn't reverence life. I can't think of any peoples who have had more reverence for life.
No. If you value want to make the lives of the people who exist the best they can be, surely.
Exactly. And
you don't want too many of them so that everybody suffers.
Right. You don't want to bring a bunch of children into the world who will then suffer.
No. And this is one of the things for me right now with the environment. I have two kids, and I know you have kids too. And I look at the world that they're going to be left to deal with, and I just think, you poor buggers. I really do.
I know.
I thought, going back to 1967, I've seen that something was going to happen at some point. What surprised me is that I got to see it. I thought it'd be probably a couple of generations later. But everything's going so fast now. You look at the loss of ice in the Arctic. You know, it's way faster than anyone had been predicting. I mean, 5 years ago, they were saying, like, you know, 2100, oh, there might be no ice at the North Pole. Now, a bunch of American climate scientists actually have a book running as to whether it will be before 2020 when there's no ice. They have a book running, climate scientists. Now, these are guys who know what they're talking about, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just horrendous. if you look at the worst, well, if you look at the reasonable case scenario, not the rosy picture that's being fed to you by the corporate media, we're already committed to probably 8 meters of sea level rise based on carbon dioxide as it is now. The last time it was at the levels it is now, we were 8 meters higher. So, goodbye Holland. Goodbye Bangladesh. Goodbye most of the coastal cities of the US, Australia, etc. London's gone. You know, and this is what we're probably, not maybe, probably committed to already. You know?
Oh, you're just using scare tactics. You're using scare tactics because you're one of them liberals what wants to enforce your liberal socialist Marxist agenda on good, God-fearing conservatives.
Okay, let me just run a simple, really simple scenario.
I mean, I'm just...
Everybody listening here.
Right.
If I'm standing in the middle of the road and there's a car coming towards me, I have two choices. I can stand there and hope that car misses me, or I can get out the damn way. Now, we have two choices with the environment. We can think we'd better look after it just in case, or stuff it, let's hope it misses. That, for me, is the deal. And it's similar to all the stuff around drug testing for the pharmaceutical industry. They should have to prove it's safe. We shouldn't have to find out that it's not. And so anything that's proposed to be done in environmental terms has to be done on the principle of what's the worst thing that could happen here? Make the decision based on that. Not what's the best thing that can happen here? Base it on that. Because if you screw up with the worst case scenario being your decision maker, you're probably going to be all right. But if you screw up on your this decision being made on the best case scenario, you could get yourself into some really deep...
And the whole world with it. Yes.
Exactly.
You've just given a pretty good scenario, not good, wonderful, of the difference between environmental thinking and corporatist thinking.
Yeah, I mean corporations are.
I mean these dumb bastards, Dave, couldn't even they couldn't even imagine they couldn't envision the corporations and business in general never thinks in terms of the hard times. They never do. They couldn't imagine that. They couldn't imagine the dot-com bubble bursting. They couldn't imagine the toxic mortgage bubble bursting. They can't ever imagine that things are going to be anything other than what they are, and the what they are that they imagine is that they just keep getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and everything's all happy.
Yeah, but here's the interesting thing about that mentality. If I have a ton of sand over there, and I shovel that ton of sand to somewhere else, I've got a ton of sand out somewhere else. But what these guys do is they take $1,000 and they shovel that $1,000 from one place to another, and in doing so, they produce $30,000 and scoop off about $10,000 of bonuses and commissions for themselves. And that was all based on $1,000, and it's still only $1,000. And this is the thing about what's going on right now, is the money was never really there. It was smoke and mirrors. And the smoke has blown away, and the mirrors have tarnished. And now everyone's seeing that that money that all these clever people like Mr. Greenspan were saying was there, actually wasn't. That's what's happening right now.
Yeah, the Wizard of Oz turned out to be a fraud.
There. Yes, a Ponzi scheme gone bad is what it all is.
And that's why we have to think, you know, environmental folks tend to think about renewability and sustainability in environmental terms. What we've got to do is expand that thought into the so-called business schools.
What we need is long-term thinking, simple as that. The problem with the political systems of the developed world are they're all short-term and they're all about getting re-elected. You've got 4 years. So what happens? Somebody gets voted in, And so they have to kind of transition for a year, and then they might be able to do something for a year, and then for the next 2 years, they've got to worry about getting reelected.
Right. And some of that is by design, though. For instance, in the U.S., it's 2 years on the House of Representatives because it's a humongous body, and you want turnover.
Yeah.
6 years on the Senate and 4 years on the presidency. See, I've done a lot of thinking about this, Dave. And in terms of American politics, I honestly believe, and I don't want anybody thinking I'm being a hypocrite about this. I honestly believe, and I would have argued it in the between 2001 and 2008, and I'll argue it now. I genuinely, sincerely believe that we should mount an effort to repeal the 22nd Amendment, the term limit on the presidency. Because then, to the extent that you have, a president enters office and starts campaigning for his second term on his second day in office.
You have to put other things in place if you do this, though. You can't leave everything else alone.
It worked fairly well with FDR.
No, my point being that if you make it so that a president can keep going and you get one in who starts stealing the election, let's see, that's not possible, is it? That's never happened. Then you've just opened the doors really wide.
Well,
so
but you've also got
to put in place sensible voting practices, which mean if you're a citizen, you can vote.
Sure.
And no one can challenge your vote.
Paper ballots, that's easy. That's an easy fix.
Oh, I know it is, but yeah, what
but the other
things,
but the other thing that you also have to do, you have to change the political culture.
Yes,
you have to reinstill a certain amount of, dare I say it, militancy into the Congress, because what you saw with the Republican Congress operating with the Republican president was a really embarrassing sort of lickspittleism. Where Robert Byrd, with whom I have some issues, even though he's a Democrat, but he's a very conservative one, and I have issues with him. But I got to give it to him that when they were starting the Iraq War, he stood up and said the Congress of the United States is completely abdicating its own powers. So you've got to have a manifest degree of jealousy. And that's the way the constitutional thing was set up, that there would be jealousy between the three branches. And that jealousy would actually be good insofar as that's where the check and the balance is supposed to come from, is institutional jealousy.
Well, I don't. Jealousy, I always see jealousy as being really destructive, so I kind of have issues with things on principle sometimes. Maybe that's where I fall down in this world.
But for instance, even with the Democratic Congress these last 2 years, the Democratic Congress, which was supposed to stand in opposition to George Bush,
they have the same vested interest.
They have the same vested interest, and as a consequence of that, you said changes have to be made. The change that I would make is to make the Congress deadly in earnest about keeping a constant eye on the presidency and taking away the ability to act in a despotic fashion by constantly reminding him that impeachment is there and impeachment is real.
Oh, that's absolutely key. Impeachment has to hang over every bugger in government. It really does. I mean, one of the things that I always have problems with is, based on just everyday life, if you screw up big time at work, you lose your job. If you screw up in politics, you seem to get promoted.
Well, look.
Have to start getting involved in the real world.
Classic example of that, Dave. A couple of nights ago, I was being a little bit enigmatic, talking about the new code name that has been applied to Barack Obama. It is Renegade, and my mind works
probably a real big dig.
My mind works a little bit funny, but I'm a 40-something old disc jockey. And I have this vast repository of crappy old 70s and 80s lyrics that are just scorched into my brain. And I took into account, all right, I took into account the fact that the people who probably did the code name choosing were supervisors inside the Secret Service. And those guys are my age to maybe a decade older, 45 to 55 years old, let's say. So they have the same experience that I have in terms of music culture.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this is going to just seem loopy by the time we're done, but just bear with me. I'm really not insane on this. So
yeah, you know what they say about that.
So I coupled this with some stories that I found a while back, namely, to wit, that there has been ongoing litigation inside the Secret Service about its culture of racism and discrimination. So then the court ordered the Secret Service to turn over a bunch of internal emails. Well, it turns out that the Secret Service is just filthy, Dave, with people who email nasty, epithet-laden, racist email jokes, mind you, among themselves. One of the guys who was emailing the racist jokes was on Barack Obama's security detail during the primary season. Okay, work with me here. You made the premise that if you screw up in American politics, you get promoted.
Mm-hmm. Seems that way to me.
Well, this guy who was on...
George gets to the top.
Well, but this guy, this Secret Service field agent on the security detail, when they found out that he had been one of the ones sending nasty racist emails around, did they fire him? No.
No.
Did they suspend him? No.
No.
They promoted him.
Of course.
And now we have a president whose code name is Renegade, and there's an old Styx tune that has the line in it, "The jig is up."
Mm-hmm.
And you may not be conversant enough with American racist epithets and culture to understand that three-letter word.
Well, for me, a jig is an Irish dance.
Well, but that's not what it is in America.
No.
That is a racist. Oh. That's a racist epithet to describe an African American.
Yeah, but you know.
And so that's a little too paranoid. But I was mainly addressing what you had described about getting promoted when you screw up. Here's a racist who got promoted for being racist.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But this, you see this stuff all the time, you know. One of the things that I find just blows my brains out is that if you actually stop and just look at the world, what's going on is so obvious and in your face that you've either got to deliberately turn your mind off or you've got to have one of those lying boxes in the corner of the room called a television that distracts you from what's really going on with the nonsense that they pump out. I've not had a television for nearly 10 years now. The best decision I ever made in my life. That I don't invite lying, manipulative people into my house, so I don't have a television. It's the same thing.
I tend to agree.
You know? The only time I ever see television when I'm sitting down at the laundromat doing my laundry. And I sit there and shake my head most of the time when I see it. It's just so beyond any sense to me that I just find it's just not part of my world anymore. And it's a great place to be. I loathe television. I've said to my kids for years, the function of television is to make money, which means that the function of television is to advertise. The television shows are just the worm on the hook.
Sure they are. That's why I deliver that little reminder every now and then when we're talking about why the horn does what it does. and barely survives in the process, is to remind people that radio or television, done commercially, exists for the sole purpose of delivering, ostensibly, a program, which is the means by which the broadcaster then delivers to the advertiser the potential customers. It has absolutely nothing about performing a service, a public service, any other kind of service, except as a service to advertisers.
Exactly. Interestingly, you've got me off onto another tangent here. I'm really good at tangents. When I was a child, I was born in 1955 in England, and I remember television being this tiny little box in the corner there. And the BBC used to start at, I think it started at 4 o'clock, and there were kids' programs on. No, sorry, it's 5 to 5. It started at 4:55. And there were kids' programs on from 4:55 until 6 o'clock. And then television went off for an hour so that parents could have time to spend with their kids, get them dinner and get them ready for bed. And then television came back on again at 7 o'clock with adult programming till 11 at night. Now, the BBC, I have bad feelings about them because of things I've seen after that. But I always thought television had great potential to be an educator and an improver of the planet. It's an incredibly powerful medium. But unfortunately, the corporate monster got hold of it.
Yeah.
You know, the Open University was another BBC thing where you could get a degree by watching TV, and maybe if you were doing, say, a science course, you'd have to go to a few labs through the years. But you could get a degree that was as good as any degree from any university through television because of the BBC. I mean, the power that television has, and now the power that computers have, if it was used in a way that was for the greater good, can you imagine? Can you imagine? I don't think I can imagine.
You know, and I don't necessarily, I'm not dogmatic enough, Dave, that I want to take it over or have the ego or hubris to think that I can determine what the greater good is.
No, I don't want to do that either. That's not what I'm saying.
No, I mean, I know you're not. I'm
not to take away exactly the subject that you're saying from the corporate buggers, because they have that. They think it's their right to use that tool to manipulate people. I don't want to do that.
Well, what we talked about last night.
Enable everybody.
Letting a religious enterprise that is supposed to be tax-free by virtue of its charitable doings, letting that religious enterprise run a broadcasting corporation that exists for commercial profit-building motives, that's an abomination.
Tax advantage right there. If it is in any state,
do business or do religion, but you cannot do both.
You can't choose the best bits of both. And that's my thing about the corporate monster. You can't choose to have the rights of a person without having the responsibilities of a person.
Well, how on earth did a religious enterprise ever get its hands on a license to use, and I would argue abuse, the public's airwaves? That's at the bottom of all this, Dave. The airwaves, the broadcast airwaves, are public. I own them. Every American owns them. It's the same thing, only backwards, with the license that the subjects in the UK purchase.
Do you want to go all the way back here?
Oh, sure.
Here's a thought, okay? Stonehenge. It's quite an old building. It's quite an impressive building. It probably was used to figure out eclipses and the like. But here's an interesting thought. Can you imagine a person who'd watched the skies for all his life and figured out when the sun might go down or when there might be an eclipse? And he says to all these guys, if you don't do what I tell you, I'm going to put the sun out tomorrow, because he knows it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, the sun goes out. Now all these ignorant people think he's just done that. Shit, I'm scared senseless of this guy. I'm really going to listen. So he says, I want you to build this thing. And in building that thing, they're actually increasing his powers and diminishing their own.
Certainly.
And this is the deal. This is where religion comes in. This is where the way the state of the planet is in right now. You have a few people who think they have the right to manipulate everybody else. And what we have to see and what people have to get is they don't have that right. Don't let them convince you that they have that right. For me, that's it.
Oh, you've taken me about six different ways from Sunday just now, Dave. You know, the anthropologists and archaeologists and sociologists, as I have read and understood, tend to think that the earliest religious forms were very simple fertility cults.
Mm-hmm. Go
ahead.
Can I interrupt you?
Please.
One of the things that I think about religion is a function of the fact that most people cannot look at the fact that one day they will end.
Well, that's the primary function of religion, is to tell them what happens when it does.
Yeah. Well, for me, I know that when I end, when I sleep at night, I rarely remember dreams, so I die for 8 hours every night. I have no fear. What scares me is getting there, how I transition from life to death, not death. But that's the game that religion plays, I think.
Well, that's part of the game. But you know, you talk about what scares you is how you get there. We have no way of knowing that a fetus entering the birth canal does not have every bit of the terror that someone facing death has.
No, we don't.
We have no way of knowing that fetus doesn't perceive what it is going through in birth as the greatest horror imaginable.
Mm-hmm.
And because all of its needs have been met, it has been warm, it has been fed, it has had no wants.
Its
comprehension has been completely tied in with the consciousness above it, in the form of the mother.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It hears voices. It hears soothing noises. It hears a heartbeat that is literally the measure of its existence for however many months.
Oh, I know.
And so religion is a way of taking the fear.
Religion is a way of answering questions that we have no answers to.
Yeah. And they're all guesses. Well, they're all guesses.
Here's the thing. Something that I've said to my kids. Can you imagine if you were someone living in a cave 6,000 years ago and there's a thunderstorm? You have no clue what's going on. This would scare the absolute crap out of you because you have no clue what's going on. Where now, you know what's going on. You've got a charge separation produced by, you know, air moving around and water vapor, et cetera, et cetera. And all it's doing is sorting itself out. But the fear of when you have no understanding of the world, the level of fear has to be fairly high when things go on that endanger you.
Fear should
help everybody.
Fear rises in direct proportion to ignorance.
Yes, absolutely.
It's graphable and chartable. And, in fact, you can see that inside our right wing.
Yep.
I started the program with that goofy-ass letter from Chuck Norris to Barack Obama about how Barack Obama has to protect life. Well, that's all motivated by fear. And the fear comes from ignorance. That man's got enough money to burn a sopping wet elephant, but he's dumber than
Bush might need you to fight a war. You know?
Yeah. You know, the right wing is motivated by fear of the black man. I mean, it's as old as dirt in this country.
Where does it come from? Where does this come from?
Religion. You know, they've got
let's ask a question here. What color was Jesus, if you believe in this?
Shh.
My thought on Jesus.
Stop that. We don't know. He was blonde-haired and blue-eyed, and we all know it.
He was probably Aryan, so let's not go there. No, but my point being that...
But, the, you know, in the Israelite holy book, in the creation myth, the southern preachers relied on the Old Testament to state that one of the sons of Noah committed a sin and God did turn his skin dark as a punishment, therefore.
Mm-hmm.
And they used that as a justification for slavery, the same way that bigots now, the sons, grandsons, multi-great-grandsons, and nephews and so forth, of those same bigots are now using that same Bible to say that in Leviticus it says, thou shalt not, a man shall not lie with a man lest he be cursed, and double cursed if he eats shrimp while he does it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all based out of fear and ignorance.
The funny thing is, yeah, again, going back to me being a teenager, well, I was talking about when I was 12 earlier. When I was a teenager, I read the Bible, the whole thing, old and new.
Me too.
Start to finish.
Because mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, the world kind of seems to revolve around this damn book. I better read it and figure it out. And the more I read of it, the more it convinced me that this was a pile. And my thought on like Jesus is he was probably more like Che Guevara than anything. And the only time he ever used violence was overturning the tables of the money changers. Now there's an interesting thing. You know, there's so much there you can play with.
Well, and there is. And lo and behold, you look into the Mormon holy book.
I know.
And you know, Joseph Smith, bogarted that story about one of Noah's sons and explained that the bad lost tribes of Israel who beat the good lost tribes of Israel, that God darkened their skin to red as a punishment that others might. Golly, Ned. I mean, these are primitive peoples.
What?
These are primitive peoples, and they don't have explanations, so they make up a palatable story they can tell to each other and the children.
Yep.
But these fundamentalists want to go on and on and on and actually believe in a 6,000-year-old earth, and they want the creation in 7 days, and Adam riding to Sunday school, and
well,
a dinosaur. And
4,006, is that the fellow? So was it 2:30 in the afternoon?
I do believe it was 2:30 in the afternoon, according to...
The 12th?
Yes.
4,006?
Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was really cool, yeah. And all these... All
Never
these
mind the fact that the recipes for beer and bread are older than that, but yeah.
No, I mean, God just put all those dinosaur bones in there just to throw us off the scent.
No, Satan did that. Satan did that to confound the unbelievers.
You got to laugh at these guys. You really have.
Well, yeah, sure. I'll laugh at them when they're minding their... No, you know what? I won't even laugh, Dave, when they're minding their own business. Okay? They'll be what Jefferson said. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. But right now, yes, they are in open warfare against the constitutional form of government that we have here.
No, they're in open warfare with sense.
Well, some of that's true, but their target is the form of their target, just the same as, you know, the so-called Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or any other fundamentalist on the planet. Their objection is with the form
control.
Of government.
Control.
They don't like who has control, and they want it instead.
Yeah. And they'll use anything they can pull up.
Beg, borrow, steal, or murder.
Or anything it takes, yeah.
Yeah.
Decent people have breaks. They have a line that they won't step over. But the evil buggers of the planet don't, and that's why they win every time. That's my thought. That's my look at the world. Decent people have breaks and will not step over a line, where evil people have no line and they'll do anything, and that's why they win.
All see, the fundamentalists are having an absolute purple polka-dotted blue screaming hissy fit right now. What's this news story? Yeah, here it is. Here's the headline. How do you like this, Dave? Gay fascists storm church, attack members.
You couldn't make that stuff up, could you?
No, sorry, this is for real.
I couldn't, but some.
Well, no, but what this is about, this is the beautiful part. This is about a group of the gay folk and people who are gay-friendly who protested outside of Mount Hope Church in Lansing, Michigan. And they and the news report, which of course comes from one of these right-wing news right-wing religion industry news services, says a group of self-described homosexual anarchists called Bash Back. Susan Fonney of the Catholic League describes what happened.
Outside, they were chanting Jesus was a homo on a megaphone. They were beating on buckets, presumably to drown out what the pastor was saying inside the church, and carrying an upside-down pink cross. They set off the fire alarm. They unfurled this big banner because they apparently were hiding in an unused part of the church, like the balcony area.
But they didn't kill anyone.
Nope, but they're gay fascists! Now, see, that's what. See, these people are fascists, and they think that they're going to divert attention from the fact that they are by calling everybody else one. Islamo-fascists, mm-hmm. Gay fascists. Yeah. Then president of the Catholic League, Bill Donahue. Now, this is the guy who said that, what was it, dirty Jews control Hollywood. This is the guy who tried to get a man murdered for making a chocolate Jesus with the nasty bits exposed. Bill Donahue laments the refusal of the biased...
Unless you're one of those guys.
I know. Bill Donahue laments the refusal of the biased mainstream media to report on what he calls one of the most disturbing events this year. Quote, if an organized group of gay bashers stormed a gay church, there's not a single sentient person in the United States who wouldn't know about it.
When you stop laughing, what do you do?
See, I'm at this place in my head and in my heart and in my world, Dave, where I can't laugh at these people. I know how dangerous they are.
Well, you know,
these are the people who condone the crucifixion of gay people on barbed wire fences because they think that they've got a First Amendment right to it.
This is one of the things around all the, you know, the amendments. They're all, you know, all these ideas are great, but they're all really a two-edged sword. They can cut both ways quite often. And, yes, the protections that are put in place, I mean, I don't know. It's based, to me, it's a basic human right, the right to think, the right to, you know, the pursuit of happiness. For me, healthcare should be a basic human right. There's so many things that, for me, in any sane world, are a basic human right. My brain just melts sometimes when I kind of have to look at these people with their agendas self-serving is fine if it doesn't hurt somebody else, but when it's self-serving to the extent that it damages everybody else, it's not acceptable. That's it.
Yeah. Not hard to comprehend, is it?
It's not. It's that's it. It's so simple to comprehend that. Why is it that you're on the radio trying to convince people of this? And I'm phoning into you so that hopefully people will hear me, and I'm trying to do the same. When really, if you actually just stop, turn the TV off, sit down, sit out on the balcony with a beer, maybe a joint too, and just think. And just think.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody did that, just think. That's all it takes. And there's too few people around who are prepared.
There are too few people around, Dave, who, excuse me, who have the necessary tools to do the thinking that you're talking about.
Yes, I know, and that's part of the failure of the education system. One of the things I say to my kids is, go to school, you'll get schooled. Come home, I'll educate you. Yeah. I make them think. I ask them questions. I say, well, so what's the logical conclusion of what you're saying here? And I make them go down that path. Because that's what's needed in the world that they're going to have to grow up in, is the ability to look at a problem completely open-mindedly and look at potential solutions and talk to other people and find out what of those potential solutions are acceptable to the most people. That's it. And that's the green issue, that's politics, that's finances, that's everything for me. That's what it's going to need.
I know. And it's a daunting task. And, you know, part of what we do here, what you're doing, what I'm doing, what everybody in the chat room's doing, is we're engaging in that thought. And we are perhaps making it a little bit more likely that the next generation will do a little bit too.
Yeah.
A little bit more.
I'm working real hard.
A little bit more.
And I'm not just working on the young guys either. I mean, I get sometimes at work I get that, oh, yeah, he's off again, which is a way that people have of saying something because they don't want to look at what you're pushing in their face.
Well, you remind me of something that was just, I think it was our buddy Dennis who sent this along, that wonderful scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail where Arthur is riding up to the castle. Old woman, man, sorry. What knight lives in that castle? I'm 37. What? I said I'm 37. I'm not old. And it's a beautiful, beautiful Michael Palin sketch with the rest
I've
of it.
I've seen that, but it's been a while.
At one point, Arthur says, well, who is your lord? And the one character says, we don't have a lord. And mm-hmm. Michael Palin chimes in and says, I told you, we're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turn to act as a sort of executive officer for the week. And then he explains it. And at one point, both of them are down, you know, just lifting handfuls of filth into a bucket or mud or something. I don't know. It's just, you know, very grim and medieval.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean,
but she says, I thought
do that kind of thing.
But the woman played by I think Terry Jones says, I thought we're an autonomous collective.
Yeah.
And the Michael Palin character, whose name is Dennis, says, you're fooling yourself. We're living in a dictatorship, a self-perpetuating autocracy in which the working class... And she says, oh, there you go, bringing class into it again.
Yeah.
And that,
I don't know. I'm with it.
Yeah, and that's a way of tuning out, and that's the same thing when you say, you know, your mates at work saying, oh, he's off again.
Yeah.
It's a way
of... I'm just in the face sometimes. I just say, can't you see this shit?
And the thing is, Dave, they can. Here's the sad part. They don't.
They choose not to.
No, they can see it. They don't care.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I've been told that because I prattle along myself. I mean, it's not just the 3 hours behind this microphone every night, I assure you. I can get Agnes in here to testify to the fact.
I think I had you pegged on that one.
And they'll get, you know, well, can't we just talk about football?
No.
Well, yeah, we can talk about football, but sooner or later I'm going to be talking about why we're not paying these people to play football. Or hoops,
well,
or whatever.
They're paying them so damn much, or whatever, but, you know.
Yeah, but I'm a college ball kind of guy, so it's more, why aren't we paying them?
I've always had issues around sport and how...
Well, it's just
in the overall scheme of things.
Well, it's interesting that baseball, which was America's first professional sport, arose at roughly the same time that Americans were beginning to look at engaging in some introspection, and wondering why they were being treated like crap while their bosses were living in castles.
Mm-hmm.
Well, baseball came along to take their mind off of all of that thinking they were doing. That thinking, that's some poisonous stuff.
Don't want to be doing that now.
Makes it, you know, you get working people thinking a hell of a lot, and the next thing you know, you wind up with Walter Reuther and John L. Lewis and Samuel Gompers and Eugene V. Debs, and then we can't build any more castles.
Yeah.
So, you know, my goal as far as my ordinary personal life is to, you know, I read a bunch of policy stuff and a bunch of current events stuff, and I try always to have a book nearby, either a new read or a reread, that has absolutely nothing to do with any of it. And I'll just go off down the garden path and read something for fun. Other people do it. Other people do it with the television.
Well, for me, reading is enormous. I mean, I kind of devour stuff, but my distraction is 3D modeling. I love to do 3D and animation and stuff.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's neat. That
for me is a puzzle to be solved. That's what I get out of it. It's a puzzle that I set for myself, and then I have to figure out how the hell I'm going to solve it. And when I do, it's like, woohoo! You know?
Yeah,
you need something out there, but that's just every now and again you need to get away from thinking about this stuff. Otherwise,
but you have to think about this stuff once in a while to make the getting away worthwhile.
Yeah, always balance, you know.
Nothing to excess.
There you go.
All things in moderation.
Yeah, a couple of beers, you know. Don't have too many. You know, try not to drive too much. Try not to eat too much, but enjoy good stuff.
Yeah, see, I was kind of feeling icky yesterday during the show because of I succumbed to temptation and did some fried chicken livers, and I know that'll make the people who are like not into meat just go, ew. But I'm sorry, I'm a little redneck boy. We do that.
Well, humans evolved to be omnivores. Let's be honest with ourselves here. Look at our dedication.
But I'm doing penance. I've got my tofu.
I just try and move the balance. I know I'm never going to give up meat. I just try and push it over as far as I can to the veggie end.
That's the funny thing. You know, I went through a pretty substantial modification of my diet in the last 6 months. And what I did with those chicken livers was kind of a rat. It was like jumping off the wagon, if you will. And
yep,
you know, I dove in lead pajamas. Let's put it that way. And my body went, don't do this anymore. We don't like you for this.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Unfortunately, about 13 years ago, I was hit with rheumatoid arthritis, which is a particularly nasty thing to be hit by. And that meant that because of the stuff that I have to take, I can't drink. Or at least I was allowed one beer a week, which is really hard. Like, it's like having one piece of chocolate, one beer a week.
Right.
I understand having to modify your life to deal with what you need to deal with. And how sometimes you look over at it and you think, I'm going to go nuts. And every now and again, twice a year, I miss off the pills and I have a few beers. But I only do it twice a year.
And you've got them marked on the calendar, don't you?
Oh, I look forward to it. I really do. You know?
Yeah, like a little kid with an advent calendar.
That. Yeah. I absolutely understand those chicken livers.
So, but you know, they tell me they're going to have them every Tuesday from now till like the end of the year, and it's, I guess I can't do that. But man,
smell them.
Oh, they were beautiful. They had this lovely, lovely fried coating around them, and they were done up with onions and green peppers.
Aroma. No calories in aroma.
That's true. That's true. I can get one of those god-awful rice cakes and eat it while sniffing fried chicken livers. There we go.
Yeah. Well, you see, it's like me. I'm a nicotine addict who's been off for 10 years now. And I love the smell of cigars, and there's a few people that I work with who are big on cigars, and I just stand there and smell it, and I know I'd love to have a cigar, but I know.
Well, then I'll rub it in a little bit. I had a lovely little cigar for the beginning of the program. Because my list of vices has just been, it's been shearing away like sheets of mica off of a, you know, just. There goes another vice. But I've still got my cigars left and the occasional beer. And yep. That's about all there, and my cigarettes. That's about all there is left.
No, I don't do those.
No, I hate them. Oh. I hate them, but, you know, I'm a junkie.
Wherever
Rush Limbaugh went to talk to the horses and get over his street drug problem, I need to go and talk to the horses for a week. Hey, Mr. Ed, come here. You got to smoke. You know, mm-hmm. That kind of thing. Because I've done the quit out in the world thing, and I apparently I'm not that guy.
Well, here's an interesting tale for you. My dad was a chain smoker. He's paying big time now. He has emphysema and various other issues. And I can remember, again, going back to being a kid, him saying, don't ever do this. And he took a white handkerchief and a cigarette. He inhaled, and then he blew through the handkerchief and said, look what it does to your lungs. And that stuck with me. But here's how I ended up smoking. In England, if you smoke those illegal things, it's mostly hash. And everyone rolls it with tobacco.
Sure.
And that's how I got a nicotine addiction.
Well, that's kind of a low-rent version of Keef, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't Keef a ground-up rendition of the hash that's and raw opium and tobacco and... Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's how I developed my nicotine addiction. Never. I was always really anti-tobacco. But that's how I got mine. If I'd been here, where I am now, that would never have happened to me, because it's all green here.
Right.
And you don't need the tobacco.
True indeed. Well, Dave, this has been a wonderful conversation.
Well, we do have some good ones, you know. I mean, I keep thinking, you know, the old, I have one mouth and two ears, therefore I should listen twice as much as I speak.
Right.
I try not to phone in. But I sit here and I'm hearing it, you know. I'm talking about addiction. I think head on is probably up there with nicotine right now.
Well, I would.
Because I just find I keep going in and looking in the chat room, and I'm in there, and I think, you know, I'm not going to phone in tonight.
Yeah, but you know, I want to encourage that addiction, and I want to encourage you to, like, you know, stand on street corners and get other people hooked too.
I've told a lot of people. I've emailed a lot of people. You know, for me, the more people I can wake up, the better this world may become.
Yeah,
that's it.
Exactly.
That's
exactly
what I want to do.
I know. Then that's.
I don't want to bore you. I want to make you think. And thinking is not boring.
And you know, whether it's the conversation with you or with Albert or with anybody else who calls in here. The beauty out of this, Dave, as I've noted, is A, what I get out of it, because I'm a selfish person.
Yeah, but you put a lot in too, so you.
But the other thing is the idea. I don't know what's on right now out there on the internet besides me. I'm sure there's some internet radio station playing 80s music, and another radio station playing bluegrass, and another internet radio station.
The
KKK's out there. There's some right-wing blatherhead. I know for a fact there's a religion industry nut who is well-financed by the American Family Association who operates about this same time.
Yep.
So all of that's there. And a lot of them have these things, these people on that they call experts.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, you know, he's in Washington, D.C., and he's an expert on politics, or he's an expert on law, or he's an expert on auto mechanics, or
you know what the first thing that flashes into my head when someone says expert?
What?
Okay. Tell me who says he's an expert.
Bingo.
Why.
Right. Exactly. It's a Republican consultant. Apparently, all you need to be a Republican or Democratic consultant is for Fox, CNN, NBC, or whatever to say you are.
Oh, so you have to have an IQ below 80.
Just about. But what I get with this program, instead of anything else that's going on the internet, I get people who really are experts, people who have proven their expertise by virtue of their ability to survive in a very complex, chaotic, cruel, and confusing world.
The same world.
Yeah. And if you can do that, by God, you are an expert. And people prove it on this program every night, and that's just what gets all over me. Just blows my tiny mind.
For me,
My idea is, I think I might have said this to you before, but at the risk of repeating myself, my ideas for me are like sparks. Sparks can start a fire. And if I can fire those sparks out and they start a fire in the right places, maybe we can change things. And you're doing the same thing. And then the exchange of ideas, you give me a piece of information that says, hang on, oh yeah, that was that piece of that damn puzzle I couldn't quite get my head around. Okay, we got it. In there.
I got the corner piece. I got the corner piece. It's all going to come together now.
Yeah, and that enables me then to form my thoughts better and throw a few more sparks out there, and somebody else might do the same thing. And this is the great thing about an honest exchange of ideas.
Yes, precisely.
That's the power of ideas.
And I think this is what we're doing, not to be too egomaniacal about it. What we're doing is precisely that. And the beauty of it,
yeah.
The beauty of it, Dave, is that we're doing it very, very well. You know, I had a message from Mark Levine earlier this evening saying, you know, sometimes I feel like we're painting portraits that are on a desert island. Just in terms of, you know, trying to make this exposed to more people, because this is one of those few opportunities where we're not trying to leverage an audience as a reason to sell crap.
Yeah.
If we find something worth having, we'll tell people about it. You know, there I was mentioning the coffee company, superbeans.com. Great stuff. I don't expect anything for that. I'm not asking anything for that.
No.
I mention it because I've used it, I like it, and I think it would be beneficial because of the fact that it's sort of non-commercially toxic, and other people might want a piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a far cry from encouraging people to pick up the phone, call some toll-free 800 number, and order a patent baldness remedy that ain't gonna work. But to do it because there's money in lying to people.
Back to the corporate monster.
And there we are. Dave, we'll talk to you soon, brother.
You certainly will. I'm not going to leave you alone.
I know you won't, and I'm glad you won't.
You know, just very quickly,
yes.
I found you by fluke on iTunes, and I'm fine that I go in the chat room and I talk to you, and it's like kindred spirits. People who think, and that's why I keep coming back, and that's why you've not heard the last of me, and have a great night.
You too, Dave. Thank you. Bye now.
Bye.
It is kindred spirits. It's community. It's a three-year-old community that we've been able to build. You, me, all the hosts on the horn, all of us working together. And it's humbling. I want to throw something your way. We started out the program with that letter from Chuck Norris. What a moron. And this is a beautiful rebuttal of sorts to the same. This was authored by our chat room moderator, ELO, known in the real world as Sue. Not going to tell you where the Batcave is. you know, I'm Alfred. We're all in remote, undisclosed locations, Agent Fred. You'll never find us. But this is a beautiful rebuttal to all of that. Republicans, namely the 20-some percent that still think the sun rises and sets on G.W. Bush, are upset and nervous, and rightfully so. They can now see that the unchecked powers they felt Bush needed can now be used by someone else against them. Thanks to the unitary executive theory they've been able to implement, Barack Obama will be able to listen to your phone conversations, read your emails, and pry into your everyday life anytime he feels like it for any purpose he chooses without ever needing a warrant. Neat! He can label you a terrorist, throw you in jail, and never have to give you a trial because habeas corpus was suspended when the Military Commissions Act Bush wanted was passed. Sweet! If another terrorist attack hits our shores, he can wait 411 days before forming a commission to investigate it refuse to fund it, and when all else fails, he can refuse to testify under oath about what he knew. Awesome. If Obama's deputy chief of staff is ever under congressional subpoena, they can just ignore it and go get a TV show someplace. Hey, if it's good enough for Karl Rove, it's certainly good enough for any Democrat, right? Excellent. If anyone on Joe Biden's staff is convicted of anything, Obama can issue a pardon before the person ever does a single day in jail. Scooter Libby style. Far out. He can run up record budget deficits and increase the national debt more than every other U.S. president combined. If anyone objects, question their patriotism. You will not defy the president or his decisions, citizen. Cha-ching. No need to keep track of administrative electronic communications, as the law demands. Nope. Just run all the emails through the Democratic National Committee servers and then give us a great big oopsie when the backup tapes are accidentally destroyed. Nobody marched on Washington when the Republicans did it, so Americans don't mind. Yeehaw! And above all else, if Congress passes any law Obama doesn't agree with, he can just issue a signing statement and render the law useless. And if anyone ever questions your authority, just claim executive privilege and tell the citizens nothing. Slam dunk! Except, none of these things are neat or excellent or sweet or awesome. In fact, they fly in the face of the accountability American citizens expect and demand from our elected representatives. I've had staffers from representatives of both parties, including the White House, hang up on my phone calls and leave my written correspondence unanswered. It's never stopped me from my attempts to hold them accountable. These staffers ain't seen nothing yet, though. As a Democrat, I didn't expect any more from the Republicans than what we've already gotten. But as a Democrat, if the elected representatives of my party think they can pull that crap, the crap I just outlined above, and get away with it, they've got another think coming. I'll gladly sit in jail if it means letting the representatives of my party know that acting like the party that was just overwhelmingly voted out of office will no longer pass as doing the will of the American people, not ever again. And in those paragraphs is distilled the essence of the difference between being a liberal and being a conservative. Because we recognize that there are things need fixing. And we recognize it'll take hard work to do it, and we recognize that there's a political system involved here that runs counter to really doing the hard work. Knowing all these things, we recognize that it's going to take a mighty push. A mighty push to get done what's needed done. And we recognize that now is the time when we really start screaming from the rooftops about habeas corpus and torture. And the notion that if a law that says don't do this doesn't mean don't figure out a way to do it without breaking the law. It means don't do it. They are authoritarian drones. We are free of mind, free of spirit, with clear consciences. We don't want done to the opposition what George Bush wanted to do to us. Perhaps that will prove to be our failing. But if it is our failing, it will be so because we acted within both the letter and the spirit of the Constitution of the United States. And no one can ask any more of us than that. I think that's pretty close to accurate. And I sincerely hope that there is truth in what I've been reading coming out of the Obama camp, that they are studiously working day and night to roll back the depredations of the Bush administration. If our constitutional form of government cannot function without violating that constitution, then we are no longer operating under that constitution. We have things that are broken that must be put back together. And that is our job. Thank you all for joining in this evening. Thank you for downloading, podcasting, whenever it is that you listen to the program. It is your ideas. It is your participation, your conversation, your writings, your emails that make this all worthwhile. And I thank you. It is your financial support that makes it all possible as well. I want to thank the individual who last night sent in $100 and the individuals who have sent in money in the last couple of days in whatever amount. If you were listening to the conversation with Dave, you get an idea in what he said of what it is, you know, thinking, having ideas, observing the world around you, and then talking about it. The idea, the philosophy behind what we're doing here. I started out on one tack, and Albert took us from that one idea into 100 others. You tell me one other place, broadcast television, anywhere, that what you heard tonight and what you hear every night and what you hear every day on the horn, whether it be me, whether it be Guy, whether it be Mark, or whether it be what you hear on the weekend, you tell me anywhere that happens. I don't think you can. I've looked. This is the only place that this is happening. The only place. And the fact that this is the only place that this is happening isn't made possible by a generous grant from DuPont or advertising for patent medicines. This is the only place that these conversations happen because you decide that you want to make it happen. And as I've said a million times before, I'm humbled by that. And I thank you for your dedication to creating something utterly different, more invigorating, more enlivening, and more inspiring than anything going on just about anywhere else. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thanks also go out to Peter Godbold, to John Fox, and to Ben Birch. They're a critical, integral part of all of this going on. Thanks go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. You heard a lot of discussion tonight about what taking care of the environment means. And they were lovely conversations. They were invigorating conversations. Now imagine trying to carry on that conversation with coal thugs screaming at you, attacking your home, and trying to literally run you off your own land. You'll understand why I say they're the bravest people I know when you do try to imagine that. And always, 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 RMR,
Gina, it's all for you.
From Washington, the inside scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the inside scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the inside scoop. You may think the election is over. You'd be wrong. Sure, we have chosen our president, and I'm looking very much forward to January 20th, just 2 months and a week away, till we finally get rid of the Cheney Rove creature called George W. Bush, who occupies the White House. But the Senate races and a few House races are still continuing. Last we checked, there were 57 Democratic seats and 40 Republican Senate seats after Mitch McConnell unfortunately won his close race in Kentucky. I really wanted to win that one. I wanted to knock off that guy. And then Roger Wicker won in Mississippi. It's 57 to 40 with three states left: Alaska, Minnesota, and Georgia. Georgia, as you know, is going to a runoff December 2nd, and that one's going to be tough. I don't suspect we'll get the same kind of African-American turnout as we did under Obama, but who knows? If Obama's people will go down to Georgia, and apparently a large number of them are, and go there with the same kind of support and say, Barack Obama needs your help. Frankly, I think President-elect Obama needs to go down to Georgia, but that may just rally up the white people who opposed him. You know, Georgia was a close race, but Obama didn't win Georgia. McCain won Georgia. So, you know, I don't know whether Obama should go down there or not. I'll let y'all help make the decision. Before we even get to Georgia, we've got Alaska and Minnesota. And it may surprise you to know that Alaska is coming our way. When, after election night, it appeared that convicted felon Ted Stevens was going to be reelected in Alaska, I admit it, I let loose on the Alaskan people. And I got to say, they're surprising me in a good way. First, they surprised me in a bad way. You know, okay, they're voting for their native daughter, Sarah Palin. Yeah, she doesn't know anything about anything, but she is Alaskan. And very much so. So I understand why they voted for McCain Palin. But voting for convicted felon Ted Stevens and for indicted, soon-to-be felon Don Young, the sole congressman from Alaska, that one surprised me. And Sarah Palin was already talking about what she would do. Because if Ted Stevens wins re-election and is expelled by the Senate, which almost certainly would happen, then there would be an election in Alaska. And let's face it, Alaska is a very red state. Sarah Palin is very popular there. She would likely be a new Republican senator. But Alaskans have surprised us. I myself was surprised by the fact that there were some 90,000 votes that were uncounted on election night. First, we thought there were about 40,000. Now there appears to be about 90,000. This in a race where the counted votes are about 125 to 125. On election night, Ted Stevens was ahead by 3,000 votes. So 250,000, and then a whole nother 90,000, one-third, more than one-third of the counted votes, remain.